Colonel Jacobs, if you'd also come and sit in front, please. Where's the state law at once? Is there enough place for them as well? Members, we are ready to start. Good morning to all members. The technical team from the department, the Secretary of Police, State Law Advisors, Council and CIRA. We're going to start today's meeting with a feedback on the consultation processes that we instructed, with the committee instructed the technical team to have over the weekend, Friday and over the weekend. I'm going to ask the Secretary of Police to report back on those meetings, and thereafter we will continue with the amendments as we have instructed the technical team to go and have a look at. So if we can start, Secretary, with you, please.
Thanks, Chairperson. Just on the issues that we were asked to go back and come back to the committee on, there are two issues. The one was consultation with departments, and the departments that were identified were the Department of Trade and Industry, the Department of Home Affairs, National Treasury and State Security. And then we were also asked to look at what exemptions have been made with regard to the private security industry. So I'm going to start with the consultation process. That on Friday afternoon there was quite a long and in-depth, a three-hour meeting with representatives from DTI. We met with a delegation of five people, including the DDG responsible for international cooperation and agreements in DTI. A copy of this written as requested has been submitted to the chairperson, so what we are reporting back now is in writing for the chairperson's attention. As I said, the discussion with DTI was quite long. We spent 3 hours on Friday afternoon with DTI regarding the issue. The main focus of that was the issue of foreign ownership and limitations on foreign ownership. The officials from DTI stated up front that they support the policy perspective regarding foreign ownership and understood the rationale behind it. However, they raised certain difficulties in the enactment of this clause as it is in the Act currently. The issues that they raised relate to aligning our position with bilateral and multinational agreements, and in particular the World Trade Organization agreement, which was signed with more than 150 countries in 1995. DTI are saying that you can't necessarily rule out the possibility of placing limitation on foreign ownership, but the amendment as it stands now requires significantly more research and further exploration of this clause, and has to be linked to properly understanding and addressing our international agreements, and that this has to be done before we address the clause. What DTI agreed to after the three-hour meeting is that they would be prepared to work with a technical team to further explore this option. However, this process needed to be very detailed and defined in terms of our international obligations. So that's the long and the short of what DTI are saying. They're saying that if we want to, it's not an impossible clause to implement, but as it stands in the bill, it would be problematic, and that there needs to be a technical team, and they would be happy to work on that technical team that aligned it with our international obligations. I mean, if people would like to ask further questions on it. Yesterday evening, there was a discussion held between myself and the DG of State Security. Unfortunately, the technical team wasn't able to be part of that meeting. They also expressed the concern research and needed to be done on the issue of the foreign ownership, and that they would also be happy to be part of a technical team with DTI and ourselves to look at further research and redefining this area. With regard to the consultation with Home Affairs, just to give you a sense of who was consulted in Home Affairs, we consulted with the head of legal services in Home Affairs, who in turn decided that it was important that we consult with the head of the immigration policy section in Home Affairs. So both the legal section of Home Affairs and the immigration policy section of Home Affairs were consulted. And basically they were given copies of the bill on Friday night and spent quite a portion of the weekend going through the bill. They then basically responded by having discussions with General Jacobs and members of the legal technical team yesterday, but also gave us a written feedback. Home Affairs' response was that in terms of Section 22 of the Constitution, it restricts the right to choose trade, occupation or profession to citizens only. However, Section 23 of the Private Security Industry Regulation Act, enacted in 2001, extends the right to permanent residence. And the question that's been raised by Home Affairs is, once you have extended that right, can you then take it away at a later stage? They felt that the issue of that you also needed to look at certain court cases that had arisen, including the Union of Refugees Women versus the Director of the Private Security Industry Regulatory Authority of 2006, where the court stated that permanent residents have the right to reside in South Africa and enjoy all the rights and privileges, duties and obligations of citizens, save for those which a law or the Constitution explicitly ascribes to citizens. They also then looked at another case, which is Causa and Others versus the Minister of Social Development, which is a 2004 case, where the court held that there are important differences between citizens and permanent residents in terms of the Immigration Act, and they do not have the same rights, privileges, and obligations which a law or constitution explicitly ascribes to citizens. Thus, they do not enjoy political rights, they do not enjoy the right to choose a trade, occupation, or profession freely. So Home Affairs felt strongly that on the refugee issue, it was clear. On the permanent residency issue, the problem was that a right had been given, and now we were taking away that right. So as far as they were concerned, we needed to look at that issue, and I think the legal team have been looking at that issue. But the issue of taking away permanent residency from registration from people who had already registered in CERA would be problematic. However, Home Affairs also raised an issue with us during these consultations, which was that under Section 28 of the Immigration Amendment Act, there is a provision that your permanent residency can be taken away if it was fraudulently acquired. Now, one of the issues that the corruption section of Home Affairs have raised with us is that they have, in the last year, taken away permanent residency status from a number of people, some of whom have been registered as private security guards, because their permanent residency was fraudulently acquired. So their position was that if we're going to deal with the issue of permanent residency, whether it is people that have already registered with CERA, or if we include permanent residents going forward, we need to align our position with Section 28 of the Immigration Amendment Act, which says that if that permanent residency was acquired fraudulently, and Home Affairs removed that permanent residency, that immediately their registration from CERA is withdrawn with immediate effect. So that was with regard to Home Affairs. With regard to National Treasury, at this point we have been consulting with the Chief Director in National Treasury, who is responsible for the JCPS, so the entire police justice budget within the cluster, so would be responsible for all the budgets that fall under the Minister of Police. However, he's also asked for a follow-up meeting which involves the head of the public entities section in National Treasury. The issues that have been raised by National Treasury is that, first of all, Section 8 of the Private Security Industry Regulatory Act of 2001 needs to be aligned with the prescripts regarding public entities, where at the moment that provision says that the remuneration scale of council members is determined by the minister, and they are saying that in terms of other public entities it should be by the minister with the concurrence of the Minister of Finance. So that's one specific amendment that they requested be made. The other point that Treasury have raised is that there are two models under the PFMA regarding the funding of public entities. The first model is the model where the entity funds itself, and where Treasury steps in if there are specific funding requirements, for example, the SAA example, but that has to be motivated and then included in the appropriation money. So it's not funding of the entity itself, it's specific funding for specific purposes. The other model is a model where the public entity receives funding from levies and other monies that come into that public entity, but Treasury then they get money as part of a budget vote for that entity. And Treasury is saying to us that at the outset we need to have a decision on which model of funding we are going through, and that needs to be jointly agreed between National Treasury and the public entity, and agreed to by both the Minister of Finance and the Minister of Police. And that is something which they have asked for a workshop this weekend with the public entity section head, ourselves and Treasury around. However, in relation to the current bill and the current costing structure, the position of Treasury is that costing structure theory needs to be related specifically to the implementation of the bill and not to general funding costs for Sarah. So the costs that are presented to the Portfolio Committee with regard to the bill need to be specifically related to the amendment bill itself. Mm-hmm. Other processes relating to other costs that Sarah may request from Treasury needs to be a separate process and brought back to the Portfolio Committee. That Sarah and National Treasury, that the costing structure be withdrawn, and that it be discussed in the meeting with National Treasury, the workshop with National Treasury this weekend, and that what be presented is a costing structure specific to the bill itself that National Treasury approves and concurs with that costing structure. Okay, that's on the consultations. The second issue was we were asked to look at by the Portfolio Committee what exemptions had been granted. Now, when we looked at the private security...
Let's first deal with this issue of the consultation processes. Members, is it clear in everybody's mind what is said?
Yes.
It's clear. What we, in summary, so for minutes' sake, what we are saying is we're going ahead with the bill, because there are also issues within the current Principal Act that needs to be tightened up that has resulted in some difficulties for CIRA. We're going ahead with the bill without the reference to ownership. If we do include the issue of citizenship, we need to do it within a certain understanding. So when we get to that clause, we will talk about whether we include or exclude that. Our members clear on the process ahead. Bill is not withdrawn. That section will require additional involvement of different departments, the section on ownership. It will require, if I understand correctly, the renegotiation of some of these international treaties that has been signed, etc., etc., and therefore that is a separate process, and by the time when they're done with that, they can bring it back as an amendment bill to what we are busy with currently. So we will continue with our process. We will finalize this bill with the necessary changes, and there will be, in a year's time, hopefully, an amendment to what we are finalizing today, dealing with ownership. Mr. George.
Madam Chair,
let me thank Jenny for the this report. I might have understood him. There were two fundamental issues in this bill. One was the issue of ownership. And if I understand the meeting with the DTI, which I must say, Madam Chair, it's a pity whoever was dealing with this bill in Syria must be told, and the people of Syria, the council, everybody must be told that Parliament is serious. This is not a gambling place. Because the way the council and Syria behaved is not acceptable. Members of Parliament are not people who have nothing to do. They came here, they said they have consulted. If you listen to this debate, it's clear that there was no consultation. Because those are the key departments that should have been consulted. The DTI was important. Home Affairs is important. And if you look at the report, it's very clear that they were never consulted. They came here with a meeting which was on the 21st. October, and they call that consultation. I just want to say to them, this must begin. I look at them, some of them are very young. They still got a long way to go in life. They must begin to do the work seriously. Because if they did the job properly, consultation would not be in this situation in which you are. No, they just, like typical civil servants in South Africa, just doing it. For the sake of doing. But I'm coming back, Madam Chair. You are saying DTI says consent. It says first, the principal agrees with it. In fact, DTI speaks like we spoke here. We said the principal of the bill were agreed with it. But there are certain trade agreements. They said more research is needed. Home Affairs, it's a permanent resident. It says we can't take the rights which has been given. They differentiate between permanent residency that has been acquired fraudulently. Now, Treasury, you know the way it was presented here, it was as if it's a de facto case that they're going to get money from Treasury. Now, there's no way to wait a bit. Firstly, it gives two models how public entities can get funds. And from what, and Treasury says to us, take out that thing. Now, Madam Chair, I have no problem with what you're saying, but I ask myself a question before I ask you. The fundamental issues in this bill are taken out. The funding is taken out. Permanent residence is taken out. Foreign ownership is taken out. What is it that we are going to deal with in this amendment bill now?
Any other member who wants to make a comment or wants to ask a question, Ms. Ndlovu?
Chairperson, firstly, I must follow my colleague by thanking the head of secretary for the consultation and the reporting on the matter. Chairperson, again, it seems as if the real issues within the bill itself will be deferred while we will be dealing with some other issues within the bill. But the most important part is what DTI have said. You will lead us, Chairperson, in this matter. But I must register my unhappiness that when this bill was introduced, it listed a lot of people that were consulted. And we must define the word consulted in this way, because it seems as if other people were not consulted at all. It was just a meeting of people and then they discuss the issues, and then they agree to have a paper in front of us. And secondly, Jefferson, it will make us work harder than what we thought we should be because of what has happened at the beginning. I take that as people who will be working overtime on our part when we are not supposed to do that because of the shaping of the bill itself. Now, that's a problem that I'm having because it's not the only bill that is in front of us that we should look at. If it was done correctly, we should have finished this bill long time ago and deal with other bills, because there are so many bills that are in front of us. But I want to zoom in on Treasury. Chairperson, when we are presented with finances, to me it seems as if there was something wrong there. Because if Treasury is saying we must withdraw what that was presented to us, must be withdrawn, there'd been somebody somewhere did a very, very bad job by telling the parliament of what they think they should get at the end of the day without a proper calculation, without the proper idea of what should be done. To me, that's a fundamental issue, because we are talking about funding and money. If people can present a document in front of us, because we have the documents here, and then we are requested by Treasury to withdraw those documents now, what do we have? What will be the implementation cost of the bill? We are going back to square one. That is my problem, Chairperson. Thank you.
Honourable Mula Bassi.
Thanks, Chairperson. Yes, the committee was somehow misled on the issue of consultation. We were given a long list of organizations, departments that were consulted, which was not the case from the presentation we get today, the explanation we get today. And it was unfortunate, Chairperson, because we were defending the department in front of the presenters for by saying we didn't have information of it. It was just unfortunate, Chairperson. Thanks, Chair.
Members, let me start with the Honourable George. Honourable George, yes, that is the principle of the Act in front of the bill in front of us, the amendment bill in front of us, but there are also other issues in the amendment bill, and there are issues within the principle Act that is not even addressed in the amendment bill, which also shows that CIRA didn't apply its mind when it was drafting this bill, that needs to be amended, that has been a challenge for CIRA in the past. So we are going to deal with that. We're going to see this basically as the committee's exercise of reviewing the Principal Act, taking in consideration the amendment bill before us, that those parts that does not deal with foreign ownership per se. Secondly, to address both the Honourable Ndlovu and the Honourable Olabatsi, I want to express to CIRA in the strongest possible terms, and I will ask the Parliamentary Law Advisor to assist the committee in this. It is clear from what happened here, from the process as it unfolded, it's not only this committee that has been lied to, but the Cabinet has been lied to as well. If you look at the non-consultations that took place and the people that were listed as part of the consultation process. And I think that should form part of our report when we finalise the bill, is our unhappiness around it. Because I want to stress with CIRA, you are, at this stage, not very credible in front of this committee. And you must know that. It's no use in us trying to sugarcoat that. Your credibility is non-existent in front of this committee. And you are the authors and the architects of that non-credibility in front of this committee. Nobody else. We don't interact with anybody else from CIRA than with yourselves. Council and the directors and deputy directors within CIRA. You have misled Parliament. You have seriously misled Parliament. You have wasted our time. You have cost us money. In terms of advertising for this bill, for public hearings, which is a process that we then, when the amendment bill becomes comes before us again, we will have to do yet again. Now, if you don't respect taxpayers' money, over and above suggesting that you start doing that, we do respect taxpayers' money. And the advertising that we had to place in newspapers that cost and come from this committee's budget is taxpayers' money. Members are quite correct that this committee's got lots of other work to do. We still need to sit with yourselves on your annual report as well. You're the one entity that's still outstanding that we still need to do. We've got the Dangerous Weapons Bill before us that we need to look at. We've got oversight work that we must do. And we do not appreciate what happened here. Mr. Chauke, I hope you're listening to what I'm saying. I do believe, members, that what has happened here in terms of the consultation process warrants for this committee a separate report to Parliament, and that's why I'm asking Mrs. Nara just to look for me at how we go about it, whether it make it part of our report on the final bill or whether we should have a separate report on what we have experienced here. Because Mr. Ndlovu is quite correct. If Treasury tells answer is, and Treasury, the reflection by the Secretary is exactly the reflection that I got from Treasury when I met with them on a one-to-one basis as well. This is not a bottomless pit for somebody's greed. And Parliament will fail in its duties and responsibilities, and this committee represents Parliament, will fail in its committees and its duties if it does not take this to task. Second issue. I've received a letter.
I'm not jumping on you, Chair. You have just asked the state law advisor.
Parliamentary law advisor.
I will think that Chairperson, let us separate the report to Parliament with the bill. Let's have our report as a committee about the way CIRA has treated us on this bill, and then have the bill in place.
I will ask Mr. Venara to have a look at that, and I will give him an opportunity during the week when he's ready to present to the committee how he believes we should go forward with that part of it, what would be the best approach, and then the committee can take a decision on that. I've received a letter from the Acting Secretary to the National Assembly. Outstanding translation of bill. The Private Security Industry Regulation Amendment Bill is currently being processed by Parliament without the official translation. Yet another one to be ticked to the Department. Please ensure that the translation is provided as soon as possible, as the absence thereof will impede the passage of the bill through Parliament. CIRA, I hope you're hearing. I hope you're taking note. And I would have thought that you know that you're supposed to be giving it in two official languages. But in any case, you will make this translation process, the Secretary, as the person leading the process now, the translation process must happen as we are continuing. Changes must be brought on as we are continuing, so that by the time that we are ready to go to Parliament on the bill, the translation is available as well for Parliament. I hope I've made myself clear on this issue.
Madam Chair, I thought we have come to a stage now. See, if you, agree now with your persuasion that we're going to continue. But I also don't want us to waste our time. Let the Department of Police do some of these things which you say they must be done by CIRA. You can't say a dead horse must do certain things. The CIRA, as far as we're concerned now, needs to be resuscitated. And that is the responsibility of this deputy chairperson of the council. Please listen. You've got a responsibility because these people are your responsibility. You employ them, not the Department of Police. I'm saying, Madam Chair, all these things of translation must be done by the department. If we don't want, after we've done all the work, where we find that certain things have not been done, I still don't understand why they did not want to work with the department from the beginning.
Honourable George, with all due respect, the point is it needs to be done. I don't care how they do it, whether they beg the department to do it, whether they pay the department to do it, whether they get outside translators to do it. I really don't care how they do it. But there's a principle for me. There are people sitting in this room earning salaries from CIRA's side. And we're not going to allow that other people do their job on their behalf.
Mm.
Just because of the fact that they are, as you say, a dead horse. The responsibility remains CIRA's. The responsibility to get this bill translated, I don't care how they do it. Even if they've got to pay somebody to do this, they will do it. I want to step off this. You want to add something to this, Mr.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, our office will be able to assist the department with the translation of the bill, of the Act, the Principal Act, and also with the amendments as we go on, as the committee continues.
That is fine, Mr. Hercules, but the principle remains. I'm not going to have spectators in this room. I'm not going to have from the department side spectators in this room who are earning daily salaries, who have messed up the time of this parliament, sitting here doing nothing. They can be assisted by whomever, but the responsibility, the ultimate responsibility, will remain their responsibility to make sure that it happens. We can't allow that people get paid and other people must come in and do their work. That's not going to happen. Can we continue to the next part of the... can I say, members, I think we need to give ourselves an opportunity as well. Last week, Thursday, we made some good progress. It's clear that the work, if the work was done that we've asked for by the technical committee, that we will be able to make some progress today as well. So if we can continue, you wanted to add something still, Secretary, before we go to the bill itself.
Yeah, the issue of exemptions was raised. Now, I think when we're processing the bill, this is an issue we need to look at, because in the Principal Act of 2001...
Sorry, Secretary, can I ask you when we get to exemptions that you raised at that point?
Okay.
Raise it at that point. Let's not confuse the issues at this stage. Raise it when we get to exemptions. So I'm going to ask, is Mr. Hercules or General Jacobs?
General Jacobs.
Can I, just from the committee side, also thank General Jacobs for making himself available. Again, we're bringing in somebody whose job it is not to do this, to come and assist the technical team with this. General Jacobs, thank you very much for that. It was a request that members made when we had what was supposed to be a private meeting. And we want to thank you for your availability and that you made yourself available. Members felt that since you were involved in the Principal Act as well, it makes sense to bring you on board and to help us. I do understand that General Jacobs is not going to be able to be with us throughout the time because, as you know, SAPS members are not allowed to take leave in December, so he will have to take his leave in this part of the year, and that has been discussed with me, and at that point we will excuse General Jacobs on that. Hopefully by that time we would have made adequate progress so that we can continue. General Jacobs, I'm handing over to you so that you can take us through, please.
Thank you very much, Chair, and Mr. Hercules will assist to ensure that there is continuity in terms of the presentation. Chair, we are working on this document that has been handed out to the members. The State Law Advisors also assisted in having the proposed amendments that had been discussed set out on the Act itself, so that you can see the context and the other sections that relate to it, Chair. Chair, I'm going directly to the amendments that have been discussed. So if we can page to page 8 of the document. It is the definition of locksmith, and specifically paragraph D. where the committee has indicated that the provision should be amended to read cutting keys and duplicating existing keys. In other words, the words otherwise than by was deleted, Chair. Chair, from there we can move on to page 12 of the bill. Page 12, paragraph E, was a recommendation that was made by the police service in terms of the Regulation of Interception and Communication of Communication-Related Information Act. So it now reads, manufacturing, importing, distributing, or advertising of monitoring devices contemplated in Section 1 of the Regulation of Interception of Communications and Provision of Communication-Related Information, and which are not listed under Section 44 of that Act, and not affected by the prohibition in Section 45 of that Act. Chair, just on the next page, the state law advisors have advised that we insert paragraph LA specifically in that position, because then paragraph M relating to creating the impression will also be applicable to paragraph LA. In other words, LA will then read protecting or safeguarding of cash or goods with a high value, including precious metals or jewelry, when transported on a public road, except when transported by a person at his or her own account or by the South African National Defence Force, or in the case of transport by escort of the service.
Miss, can I just stop here? That you would remember that is the last thing that we discussed last week, and we said they must merge the two definitions. Are you now satisfied with the definition as it is?
Okay.
We can carry on.
Chair, I'll just hand over to the Secretary regarding the exemptions.
The top of page 14, point number 2. Now, this is an issue which I think we need to discuss as the Portfolio Committee. As the Portfolio Committee. At the last meeting, there was the issue raised about what exemptions, under the current Act, what exemptions occur within CERA. Now, one of the problems that we discussed when we were looking at this, I think on Friday, when the new technical team was looking at it, is that there is a clause in the Principal Act which deals with general authority. For some reason, that clause has been put under definitions, which is something which the Portfolio Committee may want to remove it from definitions and put it somewhere else in the Act for us to look at where it's put in the Act. But clause 2 gives the Minister ability to exempt people if from aspects of the Act if it doesn't prejudice the achievement, if it doesn't prejudice the achievements and objectives of this Act. So I think that's something when we come to the exemptions, we need to look at how we can better put that, rather than in the definitions, into the Principal Act itself and into the amendment. We were then asked to look at what sort of exemptions had occurred. And I'm just going to give you three examples that have, where the Minister has granted exemptions since April 2012, where they have applied to the Minister for granting of exemptions. In the first instance, two of the directors of the company requested exemption from the Minister from registering with the authority because they were non-operational directors of that company. So they were not directly involved in providing security services. They sat on the board of the company but were non-executive directors of that company. And they provide a motivation, and based on SAFSA's legal opinion, the Minister agreed to exempt them from having to undertake security training and all the requirements because they were non-executive members of the board. The second incident was also one person from a company who, again, was a non-executive board member and a director of the company, but not an executive director, and therefore not performing security duties, and wanted to be exempted, was a business person who wanted to be exempted from having to go through the training requirements for a security officer, and exemption was granted. In the third case, there were 7 members of a board, basically, who were non-executive members, same situation, non-executive members not performing security operations and wanted to be exempt from having to undertake private security training, etc. And that they basically were involved in other businesses and just sat on the board of this company, and the minister granted exemption to all three of those cases because they were not involved in the operation but were business people as non-executive directors. So that's just an example of the way in which exemptions have worked up till now. But I think, Chair, we need to look at whether that should be in the definitions or whether it should come somewhere else in the Act.
Can we quickly discuss the issue of exemptions? But if I understand what the Secretary is saying, they are suggesting that on 14, number 2, sub 2, page 14, sub 2, the Minister may offer consultation with the authority, and as long as it does not prejudice the achievement of the Objects of the Act, continue, that we remove that into the main body of the Act. We put it where it's supposed to be. And there is a section dealing with the minister's powers and exemptions, and ideally it should be there, not part of the definition, because this is not a definition. Are we in agreement to that? Can we tell them to do so?
Madam, as she was giving examples, I was wondering, why did the Act, in fact, require that a member of the board or something there who has nothing to do with the security, why would they require that that person be trained in the first place? I mean, if I decide to buy shares in a company of private security, why should I now be required to train? I'm not going to go around and protecting anything. So doesn't this, if you look at all the exemptions, they were more executive members. Why don't you, from the very onset, make the Act such that it does not require executive members to be trained?
Maybe we should ask the Honourable George to answer that question first, since he was the chairperson of the committee and as such. I think there are two principles that we need to look at, and the Honourable George is raising a different principle that we need to look at, and it's still not answering, I think, the question of members in terms of why would we need exemptions. So can we ask also that the technical committee that we agree we remove it from under definitions, it goes to the exemption part of it, but then also that you look at that clause that requires for directors to be trained as security officers. That you also look at that clause, and when we come to that clause, address the Honourable George's concern around it. I've made a note of it myself as well. But we're in agreement we remove it from under definition. Can I get somebody to propose that officially, please? I don't want to propose it from the chair. That we remove under definitions, that it goes to the section in the bill.
I propose.
Somebody to second that proposal. Honourable Law was seconding it. Okay, so you will do that first, but we agree then to remove it from definitions. Okay, carry on, please.
Thank you, Chair. Then we go to page 22, the document, clause 8. Chair, there's two options that's presented here. The first is that a councillor is subject to this section, appointed on a part-time basis, for a period not exceeding 3 years on such terms and conditions as the minister may determine in a letter of appointment. And the second one, very much the same, but some difference there. A councillor is subject to the section appointed for a period not exceeding 3 years on such terms and conditions as the minister may determine in a letter of appointment, provided that all members of the council serve on a part-time basis.
Can I just first ask, before I ask, allow members to ask questions on this, can you explain to us what the difference between these two options are? Because it seems very similar.
I think the second one makes it more clear that absolutely all members of the council must be. I personally would prefer the second option if I must choose between the two. Yeah.
That includes the chairperson, everybody, the whole council.
Yes.
Okay.
One question, Madam Chair. In the light of our experience now, I would want to have something in the regulations about, I see the minister may determine, but as to what type of people do want as councillors? What qualifications? Because you ask yourself when you hear Is there no going to be something in the regulation? You see why I'm asking this question, madam?
Honourable Jules, can I just interrupt you? Just page one page back, then you would see it is in the, it's in the Act. It's not even in the regulation. It is in the Act. If you could page one page back, page 21, it goes there about establishment, constitution of council, appointment of councillors, disqualification for appointments as councillor, and then we come to the terms and conditions. Mr. Hercules?
Thank you, Chairman. Just on that same section 6 of the Principal Act, the council members, they're appointed by the minister in consultation with cabinet. So that is the prescript with regard to the appointment and the criteria. So by the minister in consultation with cabinet.
Yeah, but that's a political answer. And I understand exactly what the Honourable George is asking. And that for me is 7, where you've got your disqualifications that makes that you can't be a councillor. I think the Honourable George is asking what makes you a good councillor.
You know, when I say, I see what you showed me. If there is an email which I normally not appreciate, you said, not, you say,
it must, it's not doing this, not doing, I don't want that. I don't want you to say, I don't want a thief. I don't want somebody who stole it. I would like a situation where you say, this is the type of a person I want. Not he has not done this, not he has done this. Because if, I think we must, I know, Madam Chair, you will receive us done by us, but this, the, we are paying the price now. We are paying the price because all what we said, he must be fit and proper, he must not have done this, he must not have, now, I would like a situation where when we now look at this thing and say, these are the kind of people, these are the qualifications, this is the person we want. Without taking away those things, but we must know what we want.
Members, are there a general agreement with Mr. George? Because then we instruct the technical team to go and look at the qualifying clause as well. We don't take out the disqualifying clause, but we also put in a clause that says the person must be whatever Mr. George would like to see there. And he can give his suggestions to you. You can give his suggestions to yourselves. Are we in agreement with that? Okay. And are we going for option B? Can we get... Are we happy with option B?
Option B. Option B is fine.
Okay. So there's progress in that regard as well. General Jacobs, the legal team will look at a draft for us in terms of the type of people that must be appointed.
Yeah, I can maybe say we can look at the model of the DPCI head, something like in that line of the integrity and that type of issue.
Yeah.
Agree with you. We'll come back to us when we have a meeting again on that.
Chair, before we continue, there was an issue we wanted to raise that we weren't instructed to put in, but we wanted to raise, and it's on page 21, section 6 of the Act, with regard to the composition of the council. One of our concerns is that sometimes if one or two people from the council resign and it's quite a lengthy process to replace them, your council can't correct in that context. So one of the things that we are looking at doing when we bring the Firearms Control Amendment Bill is to look at the number of appeals board members and say at least. So our suggestion is instead of 3 additional council members to say at least 3 additional council members, which allows them to appoint, depending on the state of Sarah, to leave it at 3 or for the minister and cabinet to make a decision to appoint an additional 5 members because they need to strengthen council. That's all we want to raise, whether that's a possibility to look at.
Well, Stuart?
Yeah, it's very easy to say additional 5 members, but there's money involved in that. That's what we're concerned about. We were talking about budgets here, and I think 3 additional council members is councillors is fine. Make the what is required to have a meeting. Look at that instead of inflate the council.
Can I just find out from the council currently what is your quorum requirement?
Chair, at the minute it's 3, and we only are 3.
Hmm. Chair, there's a chairperson, a vice chairperson, and three additional people. Now, if there's three, there's two vacancies. Then the vacancies must be filled. And that's the bottom line. Let's keep it like that.
There was a consideration put forward by one of the presenters saying, should there or could there not be a member from the industry on this panel who actually knows about the industry and is involved? Because these members may or may not know anything about the industry. Hopefully they would know, but in some instances they may not. So has that been considered, or is it just been served aside?
Honourable
Mulabatsi? Would that not be a conflict of interest?
Honourable Mulabatsi?
Why the industry represented that case? I would think that it should be a conflict of interest when I'm talking about this. But let us debate the issue. I'm not saying that it is correct or it's wrong. But I don't see a person who have an industry sitting in the board that regulates that industry itself. Because if you are running a taxi, you don't sit in a meeting where they are talking about taxes and so on. It is the concept of it. But we will debate that issue when we come there. But at the moment, we are talking about numbers.
May I just refer members also to the fact that the Principal Act talks about an advisory board that must be established. Now, again, knowing what we are experiencing, I'm pretty sure that the advisory board has not been established.
No.
And that advisory board makes provision for people from the industry, etc.
Exactly.
And that is what needs to happen.
Yeah.
So can we look at the board? Secretary, I take in consideration what members are saying, and with due respect, I do believe that we're not going to make a difference even if we say five members. We need to have the rules around the meeting clarified, what the quorum is, and then we need to fill the vacancies. We also know our difficulty is to get people who are actually interested in serving on boards, especially when it's part-time boards. So we are basically saying it stays as it is. And then when we get to the advisory board, we can look at the composition of the advisory board. Will you please, General and Mr. Atlas, alert us when we get to the issue of the advisory board so that we can have a look at that. Please. Continue.
Thank you, Chair. We continue to page 23, Chair. This is not an issue that has been discussed by the committee, but it's a recommendation that maybe we should amend by taking out the word council and insert minister with may determine with the concurrence of the Minister of Finance. In other words, a councillor, a member or a committee member appointed by the council who is not an employee of the authority or an officer or employee in the public service may be paid from the funds of the authority such remuneration and allowances as the minister may determine with the concurrence of the Minister of Finance.
Mm.
I think it fits in with the rest of what you've mentioned, Chair.
Members, I would strongly support that. I don't know about members how you feel.
For clarity, Madam Chair, there's going to be this workshop with the finance. Assuming we take a decision that there's not going to be funds from the state, they're going to be paid from levies and whatever they're going to collect. Which means the council is going to play an important role. Now, are we saying that even if that situation exists, the appointment... You see, Madam Chair, I'm tempted to support you, primarily because, I must be honest, Madam Chair, don't say I'm talking party politics, but the way this council is sometimes appointed also is a big problem, especially the chairperson's right through. There has been what we call in politics rewards. People who are old, who have no other job, who are being rewarded, and then they are made. We'll make you a chairperson of the board. So I'm saying, therefore, if this board could be properly appointed also, and leave this thing of rewards because you were in Robben Island, you were in...
Honourable George, I think you're going where you're now not supposed to be going, really. I mean,
just saying, Madam Chair, because the problem is this board. If you look at the chairpersons of this board, even the current chairpersons.
Honourable George, remember now, first of all, we're saying we're taking away the minister's prerogative to appoint a full-time councillor, a full-time chairperson. It's now a part-time chairperson, so it's not going to be a reward for anybody to be a part-time chairperson. That is what we're saying. That's that first thing. The second thing is what this act is now, the suggestion that General Jacobs is making, is that we don't allow the council to determine their own payment for attending meetings. That is left to the minister in concurrence with the Minister of Finance. So we are actually doing away with council's right to determine their own remuneration for attending meetings. Mr. Stuber?
Thank you, Chair. Just on that point six, a councillor or a member of a committee appointed by the council, what committee does the council appoint? Is that an advisory board? Because that's not a committee. And then we must put the advisory board in. What committee does this council appoint?
Can somebody give us clarification around that, please?
I mean, Chair, I think that needs to be read in conjunction with the section, and I'm just looking for it now, that we wanted to discuss with you with regard to, it says that there are advisory committees that can be set up on specific issues by Sarah. So I think maybe we need to deal with that section and then come back to this section, because that refers to the specific committees that the council may establish, and we want to change that to must establish. So maybe we could come back to that committee section and make sure it's aligned, because those are the committees that they're referring to. It's not just general committees. It's those committees that are referred to, or we put in here committees as referred to in that section of the Act.
Can we get an example, Chair?
Refer us to the section in the Act, please.
Thank you, Chair. Section 13, committees to assist the council, on page 29 of the handout. Basically, there to...
Just give us a...
No, they're talking about, members, let me just explain to members where we are, please. We're talking about a councillor or a member of a committee. So we're talking about 6 on page 23. It says a councillor or a member of a committee. So Mr. Stuber raised the issue, what committees are we talking about? Now, these committees are now on page 29. So can we have a look at the committees on 29 and the 13? Take us through it, please.
Thank you, Chair. According to Section 13 of the Principal Act, committees to assist the council, the council may appoint one or more committees consisting out of one or more councillors, or one or more councillors and one or more other persons, or one or more other persons to advise or assist the authority in relation to matters referred to by the council and to report to that matter to the council. So basically, and then it says that the committee, and there's a proposal that Mr. Jacobs will present to the committee, that the council must establish committees representing different sectors, disciplines or interests in the private security industry to advise it regarding the regulation of the private security industry. And then 3, the council may designate a person as the chairperson of any committee if such committee consists of more than one member. 4, a committee must perform its functions subject to the provisions of this Act, the Levies Act, and any directives of the Council. 5, the Council is not legally bound to accept any recommendations made by the Committee.
Can I ask that we again separate the two principles? The one is, how do they get remunerated? The remuneration, are we in agreement? It can only be done by the Minister in consultation with the Minister of Finance. And then when we get to that page, we can look at 13 and whether we want to reword even the committees that are established there. Are we happy about that? Can we agree? So we agree with the change there that you've got on 6. You can continue. Continue, please.
Sorry, I'm just going to deal with the other changes because General Jacobs doesn't have them with them. On page 24. Okay.
Chair, on page 24, there's a recommendation that in paragraph F, 2F, that must establish and maintain liaison with the civilian secretariat for police, just to align it with the Act, and then to insert regarding crime prevention, partnerships relating to crime prevention and related policy and matters. Sorry, Chair, the sentence is a bit, it's not very elegant, but basically it says that it must establish and maintain liaison with the civilian secretariat for police regarding crime prevention and related policies.
Can you please reconstruct that sentence and give it to us again, please?
We agree with
the principle, but the sentence needs to be reconstructed. Can you come back with that reconstruction of that sentence, please? Can we continue?
Thank you, Chair. Chair, on page 25, a number of insertions relating to the report to the Minister by the Council, and those are included in paragraph B, including 1, number of security service providers registered, 2, the number of security officers registered, including category and functions, 3, the details of training undertaken by registered security officers, 4, the number of firearms registered to, lost by, stolen from, or destroyed by security businesses, 5 instances in which firearms were discharged by a security officer, including circumstances and consequences thereof, and 6 details of information of criminal investigations involving the private security industry. And then, Chair, I suppose that must be a 7, a monthly report in terms of the Public Finance Management Act, 1999, to the Minister.
Members, there you have it. Can I just say what I find missing there is training institutions. If you're going to report in this detail, why don't we have the registered training institutions and the type of training that they are provided as well? Anybody else on this issue? Mr. George?
The things that I listed here are very important. But probably when we come to a stage where we discuss the role of the council and the authority, we're going to, because if you look at these things, and it says the council must submit a report, we're going to have to need look at again the issue which we have not dealt with, the issue of capacity, because these things are detailed, because then it means working with the fire Central Firearms Register and all those things. But I'm saying I agree, but we need to make sure that, because it doesn't matter to list all of these things when there's nobody who's going to do that.
Members, I'm going to ask members to do what we do when we deal with legislation. We're not drafting legislation for individuals or the current situation. The current situation must be dealt with. That's the bottom line. We want to have the best possible legislation on the book. As we're not drafting legislation because of who the incompetent is in the ministry, we're not doing that in terms of Sierra Island. So what we need to discuss is the principle. Are we happy with this? Members would also remember that there was one of the public submissions, I think it was made by Sean Tate, around the absence of accountability for security officers' actions, and in a way this is addressing it as well. Is there anything that you feel must be added to this list?
Chair, if you look at 5, it's very vague. Instances in which firearms were discharged by a security officer. Now, if a security officer in Timbuktu discharge his firearm, who's going to report it? How are we going to get known that somebody discharged the and to keep tabs on that and give a report to the minister on that? It is not functional. It's not going to work.
Ms. Kulabarat?
Another difficulty with that phrase is that it's so vague that it actually would include a security officer at a practice range because they're discharging their weapon.
No. No. Also true.
Honourable George?
I thought there is the law that deals with discharging of a firearm, and it's defined. I thought this refers to that. There is a law that deals with discharging of a firearm. It doesn't, and it's very specific, gives a definition. So when I looked at this thing, I looked at it in terms of that law. And I must be honest, I don't see anything wrong. If you link it to that law which deals with discharging of a firearm.
Can you just have a relook at that specific at 5 for us? Because the Honourable George is making a valid point. Discharging of a firearm is you can't discharge a firearm in a public space.
Mm.
So, I mean, there are clear acts around it, but I think it does need, as the Honourable Stuber is saying, you're not going to be able to track whether somebody in a private security company who's a South African abroad has fired a firearm. So can we just have a relook at that wording of that specific, the principle again we agree on? Can we also say we have said that you look at training institutions as well? And the second one is the number of companies sold, transferred, etc. in that quarter. The transfer of companies, companies sold, etc. Because that, how do we keep track of firearms if we don't have that information? And I think that must also go to the minister. And that must, all of this combined must form part of the annual report to the committee. Are we in agreement with the principal with the changes, and they're going to sharpen up on 5 and come back to us on that? Okay. Sorry, Honourable Mulebasi.
You're talking about what the last part you mentioned. Will it include the domain security companies?
Yeah, it must include the whole status of the security industry every quarter.
Yeah.
Companies sold, companies dormant, companies transferred, liquidated, etc. Even companies suspended, it must include. It must include companies suspended. So you still got some homework on this. We agree with the principle, we're happy with it, but there are certain things that need to be added and you need to sharpen up on 5. Continue, please. Honourable George, just be a...
I'm saying they want to work with DTI, and I said, though I know DTI is not doing the job, but some of us, I know, in Parliament, were brought to companies which we sold long ago, but DTI never.
CIRA has also got a responsibility in terms of registration of those companies, and that's why it's their responsibility also to have that. So what we're saying is we're talking about their responsibility. Yeah. Continue, please.
Thank you, Chair. On the next page, page 26, paragraph 11C, it's a recommendation, Chair, to say when dissolving the council and appointing a new council, as well as taking such corrective measures as required by the circumstances in the period whilst there is no appointed council, including the interim appointment of a person or persons to ensure the continuity of the affairs of the authority. Chair, it is a practical situation that has arisen in the past, and it is sort of like an emergency measure until things are sort of clarified. You know what recently happened with some boards where the whole board resigns and the minister had to take some like emergency measures. Thank you, Chair.
See, again, this is complicated to me because we're talking here about interim appointment of person or persons to ensure the continuity of the affairs of the authority. Just a while back, there was people must be have a security clearance. Now, how are you going to implement this? If people first need a security clearance, how long is it going to take? It's a concern. How are we going to get over that?
Does somebody from the technical team want to respond, or are you taking note of the issue?
Yeah, Chair, we'll take note, but I think there is a possibility that there is a person who is vetted and that you can actually utilize in the circumstances. But there had been circumstances where the minister actually had to take even like a task team that was appointed to look at the affairs of the authority. So we thought that it's just strengthening the hand of the minister in such times in order to manage the situation.
And I requested the department just go back, the technical team go back, and have a look at what the Public Entities Act is saying around when there's a dissolvement of councils, and bring it in line with that, taking in consideration the security issue. So, because I think it becomes a relevant issue, even if we have to put in here a vetted person or persons, you know, even if we have to put that few words in here. Honourable George?
Minister, I just make a request from you, from your staff. I know you don't like me, your staff doesn't like me, but I still deserve to be given a proper document. This document I have, it doesn't have page 26, 27.
You are going to apologise to the staff because it is the technical team that you must attack. Can you make sure that one of you give him the Honourable George a proper copy?
Why is there a good point?
No, I just wait for his apology to the store. Okay, can we continue, please?
Thank you, Chair. We can go to page 29.
We agree with the principle that is there, but we want them to make sure that it's in line with the Public Entities Act when a council gets dissolved or there's no council, and also that they take the security issue in consideration that was raised by Mr. Stuber. So they're going to come back with a reworded phrase on this one. Okay, continue.
Thank you, Chair. It is in clause 13, also a recommendation to say that the council, instead of may, must establish committees representing different sectors, disciplines or interests in the private security industry to advise it regarding the regulation of the private security industry.
Where are you now, page?
29, Chair.
What about this change?
27.
Chair, that was not one that was discussed. That's why I haven't come yet, but we can look at it. A chairperson may, that's paragraph 6, may after consultation with the council require the director, contemplated in section 41, and allow any person to attend any meeting of the council on such conditions as the chairperson may determine. It's in line with the other deletions of the ranks, Chair.
No, it's a suggestion that they're making because it's there's a gap in the act. It's a suggestion that they're making that comes from the technical team themselves. Okay, that comes from Sirov, sorry. I'm now confused as well. What is the motivation for this?
What is the motivation? Can you get the motivation before?
Wait, I'm chairing the meeting. I've asked that question. What is the motivation for this? Come, Cyril, somebody answer, please.
Thank you, Chair. Can I go ahead? Thank you. Previously, the council looked at the when they wanted to appoint the deputy directors, they advertised the positions and the people that were coming through were not people that were looking for. They were looking for because of the reference to the deputy director. And the other issue was when the structure has to be taken to DBSA, it should not be confined to the statutory structure, so that when they redo the structure of the organization, they are able to look at the state entities. I think that was the motivation.
This explanation doesn't make sense to me. I don't know. Maybe somebody else understands. Honourable Stewart, Honourable George.
No, Chair. I just I'm of the same opinion of than you. It doesn't make sense to me. That's all.
Honourable George.
I was just going to request the director just to explain. You see, because they made a recommendation, and it would be good if we understand where they come from. What is the motivation? Probably tell us. You say when you don't get the people who require, when you advertise the post, if you go to what you call the deputy director, surely you must be able to say what is the equivalent of that. Because if you don't say that, you're not going to get what you want. See, that's why I'm saying, what is the problem? Problems cannot be only what you're saying that is advertising.
No, I totally differ with my last speaker. The paragraph says totally separate thing altogether. It talks about the meeting, attendance of meeting. That's why I wanted to declare also. Why did the chairperson want somebody to attend the meeting?
Can we get the council to respond to it? We're getting the council to respond.
Yeah. Chair, on second reading of it, I agree with the committee that doesn't quite make sense, because the chairperson would ordinarily exercise his or her authority with the council to request anyone to attend the meeting if it's in accordance with what you want to achieve. So I can't understand it. I must admit that it would probably be, you wouldn't lose anything if we withdraw it, because it stands, it doesn't make sense.
And in fact, if you read 5, it already makes provision basically for the chairperson to conduct the meetings as is necessary, and which would include calling people to that meeting if so needed. So if the issue is simply to remove deputy directors because we don't want them to be appointed at the proposed level of deputy directors, I'm sorry, this is the wrong place to motivate for that.
Yes.
Thank you, Chair. On page 29, then clause 13.2, it's also a recommendation, and it's to ensure the integrated approach with the industry. The Council, instead of May, must establish committees representing different sectors, disciplines, or interests in the private security industry to advise it regarding the regulation of the private security industry.
But can we hear on that issue? The one issue is the must. I'm just asking whether, if we leave it with different sectors, disciplines, or interests, whether we not too broad or not do
just
don't we need to be more specific about what we want here? I think we're all in agreement with the must.
Yeah.
Because the industry has complained about the fact that there's a breakdown in communication. Now, this would ensure that communication takes place. Honourable Stubber?
Chair, but if a committee is needed for once-off, if you say you must, then you must have that committee. If you say may, they can appoint somebody for that specific job to be done by a committee, and it shouldn't be a permanent committee. Must is for me something permanent, and May is when the need arises.
Before you respond, I also, for me, 1 and 2 is in conflict with each other currently. And maybe you need to redraft this whole section, taking consideration what is raised here, because the fact of the matter is what we're trying to do with the word must now is to ensure that there's consultation between the industry and CIRO. No, we're not achieving it by just changing May to must, especially if you look at 1 as well. So maybe if what we're trying to achieve is a consultative arm for CIRO with the industry, that we be more specific about it. And if it means a separate section, then it needs to be a separate section as well. Can we agree that we don't have a problem with principle again, but I think it's strongly placed again. Honourable George?
Madam Chair, I understand one. That's why I've got a problem with it. one talks about not only the committee we're talking about, so may suits there, but I think on this one, because this is this crux of the complaint of the people who in the industry, I think this one, there must be a committee that represents them. I think that, to me, there a must is correct, mm-hmm. but I don't believe that a must would fit a number one. I think number one is right to be left like that, because we're not talking only this committee. You talk other committees, probably including this one. This one now you have qualified that it must be done.
Mr. George, I think we're all saying the same thing. All we are saying, I think, from the side of the committee is that take two and look at it whether you shouldn't have a separate section dealing with a committee that is established, because you now also, this is not going to be a part-time committee.
Mm.
It's not also not going to be a committee that's going to be remunerated either. It's the industry being there and being an advice body on the regulations. So maybe you must take two out of it and look at a separate section dealing with a liaison committee, advisory committee, whatever you want to call it in the end. Are we in agreement to that,
yes.
Mr. Stuber? Just
to get back, you were now referring to remuneration, but if we go back to 6 and 7, remuneration has been mentioned there. So we can't say... The committee is not going to be remunerated. It, in 7 it said the remuneration and allowance referred to in subsection 6 may differ according to different officers' health. So remuneration is part of the committee. That's how I read it. If you go to page 23, on what you said just now, I'm just referring back to 23 and say remuneration is part of a committee. Thank you.
No, you're right. But I think what we're saying here is they need to go and relook it. If we're talking about a liaison advisory, whatever you want to call it, permanent committee, that committee is not going to be remunerated. Other committees that are going to do work on behalf of the council or for the council is a different story. And that's maybe why it needs to be split. Honourable Stuber, you understand?
No, I understand.
Okay. So maybe we need to split that, the two of them. Okay, you will come back to us on that. Can we continue?
Thank you, Chair. On page 31, subsection 7, the fixed establishment, the number and grading of posts of the authority must be determined by the council with the approval of the minister. I think, Chair, there was a discussion in the committee. I wasn't here, but I think there was a reference to the DPSA. The problem is, however, that council, these are not public servants in the classic sense for which the DPSA is responsible. That's why we have the specific wording that's in here.
Members, can we look at that?
I just wanted to ask the general. I agree with you. They are not public representatives, but the structure that is qualified and has got qualified people to deal with establishment grading of posts is the PSA. So, I mean, how do you expect the minister or this council to do this thing? Because now, from what I hear now, it must be determined by the council and then and be approved by the minister.
I also have a question that I want to raise in this regard. The one thing is, if you say not DPSA, then at least public entities need to be involved, because they're now going to be graded by public entities and that would determine salaries, etc. That's the one thing. The second thing is, you cannot say what you're saying unless you have sorted out the funding model. Because if the funding model is a state model, then there's a different story. So you need to clarify that issue before you can come back on a thing like that. So I would suggest that those two issues first be addressed before you come back to us. Honourable Ndlo.
What you just said, I wanted to say that if you define the funding, then you put the minister, then you put the DPSA. You can't put the minister without the DPSA.
at the end of the day, because the minister has to be there. If the minister has to be there, he has to take it from the authority, that he trusts, that it will be TPSA. It won't be the council.
No, so what we're basically saying is you need to take a decision here and you need to come back to us. Given what we're hearing from Treasury, it's most probably not going to be TPSA. It's most probably this round going to be the public entity, Minister of Public Enterprises, and the Minister of Police. But the point is you need to sort that issue out before you can come back with a clear draft on that one. Continue, please.
Thank you, Chair. On page 32, clause 16.2, also a recommendation, Chair, and I think it's just to tidy up, the authority must use its funds for defraying the expenditure incurred in the achievement of its objects and the performance of its functions in terms of this Act, the Levies Act, and the Public Finance Management Act.
Yes.
Hallelujah.
Amen.
Like members, are we in agreement with this? Thank you. Can we break here for, it's 11 o'clock for tea, 11:15 we're back. Thank you.
Thank you.
put on the wrong plate. Yeah, it takes 3/4 of an hour to pull two metal things on wheels off of one plane and stick them on that. I mean, seriously. That's what I just came to that conclusion, actually. Anyway, I'm not going to do it.
Second weekend in a row.
What is the year? Oh. And Baba Matama is Bada Babu. Hey.
Finish nugget.
I'm going to hear from the selections of mammograms and to hear from Pat
Thank you.
we start the meeting again?
No.
Can we start the meeting?
I wish I had.
We'll deploy Sierra for your game farm. They can guard your rhinos. Can we just, for clarity's sake, the document that we're working from is not reflecting everything that should be in here. For instance, if you look at the issue on the, I think it was 5 in the amendment bill and 14 in the act. Yeah, 14 in the act, 5 in the amendment bill. Yeah, 5 in the amendment bill, 14 in the act. We haven't taken any decisions on that amendment, and you now just slip it in. Now, I presume it's only a mistake. We don't want mistakes like that, please. Page 29 of the act, of the working document, and page 4 of the bill, the amendment bill. Mr. Hercules?
Thank you, Chair. We've also spotted that and we've made a note of it. But today was actually meant just to deal with the highlighted parts. In any event, but we've noted that because the deputy director issue was discussed, you know, early on in the committee. So that would have been indicated in 14. All the amendments, as indicated in clause 5 of the amendment bill, the introduced bill, would have been in red. So that was not supposed to be discussed today, but we note it should have been there. So we apologize for that.
Yeah. All we're saying is that the working document must reflect also the proposals from the amendment bill. And I would suggest that we rather work like we're doing now. Even if it's in the red, the committee hasn't discussed it yet, that we actually discuss it, we try and make progress, because then it can become the work of the technical committee going forward. So after we finish, maybe we should start with 14 now, if you don't mind. Staff of the authority. And then we can go back to where we were. So can we members go to page 29 of the working document? Staff of the authority. Section 14. You will remember, members, that what CIRA is proposing in the amendment bill is that we take away as well as 3 deputy directors. Mr. Hercules, can you take us through that quickly, please?
Thank you, Chief. On page 29, section 14. In section 14.1, it should read as follows. The council must appoint a suitably qualified and experienced person as the director of the authority, the immediate lead, as well as 3 deputy directors. That should be bracketed. On such conditions and terms as may be determined by the council. Then in subsection 2, the director, in the open brackets, and deputy directors, close bracket, of the authority must, subject to the council's direction and control, then A and the rest of that subsection remains at ease. And then,
sorry, there's a question. The 2 is the director, and then put in brackets a bracket after and
deputy.
And you put the deputy directors in bracket. So what the what CIRA is suggesting is that the 3 deputy directors be taken out. Personally, I've made myself heard on this issue where I said I don't believe we should take it out, because then we open it up for 20 deputy directors or 20 people at a different rank or whatever the case may be, and that we must be specific about it. The other issue here is that we don't want the council without the minister. The remuneration as determined by the council and agreed by the minister.
George, I thought if they're going to introduce this thing again, probably what you're going to need is the Obanagra. Because if you say now you do away with the deputy directors, you're going to have a director. Now it means, I don't know whether we're opening one bull with no other people under him, or the people appointed, this thing of removing this deputy director, can we get a proper motivation? Why are we saying there should be no... I'm not talking at the moment, I'm not talking number. I'm talking just, according to this thing, you remove completely deputy directors. What does that mean? Are you talking numbers? Is doing away with three deputy directors, and then it means the director can appoint as he or she feels 20 directors. What does that mean?
I'm going to allow Sira and the council to respond to that. Mr.
Hercules? Chairperson, just before the response, there's another amendment in subsection 3 with reference to, it reads as follows, the director, then we delete, open brackets, and deputy directors, close brackets, of the authority main writing with the approval of the council, delegate any of, then we put in brackets the word there, and we insert his or her powers, and any of, then we bracket the words, put in brackets the word there again, and we insert his or her duties to a staff member of the authority. Thank you, Chair. That's all the references to deputy directors in that section.
Okay, members, look at your introduced bill. That will give it very clear to you. Look at the introduced bill as section 5. That will give it clear to you what the changes are that is suggested by CIRA. CIRA of Council, I'm waiting for motivation.
Thank you, Chair. The proposed amendment was not to refer to the numbers as such. As I said, it was to allow the, if the structure were to be changed by the DPSA, or to allow for the structure not to be only limited to three deputy directors in terms of the other functions that the authority is dealing with.
Mr. Chair, okay, I thought you're going to stop to be creative now, because DPSA doesn't feature in this bill.
No.
Doesn't feature in this bill. So the committee is not stupid. Please address the issue. It is to do away with three deputy directors because we want to appoint more people.
Yeah.
DPSA is not in this bill. And that is what we're trying to tighten in this thing, is that even if you want to extend your structure, it must be done with the permission of the council in consultation with the minister.
Chair, thank you. I think from the council point of view, and also just given my past experience, I think that the principle that should be considered is the one of oversight. That the council reports to the minister, and in respect to that oversight role, that I think it's incumbent on the council, therefore, to account for the appointment of the director and whoever, whether they call deputy directors or the executive or whatever that top structure, the council should be reporting to the minister. You can't be reporting to the minister if you don't have an input into the appointment of that staff, because if you leave it to a director, a CEO, whatever that executive person is called, to appoint under them without those controls, then you can't account for something you don't have an input to. So I think that is the principle from a council point of view that I think should be contained in or described in that section.
Ms. Holtzman, that's not being affected. That remains. That is there. What we want to see is that it's tightening it even further. Where it says currently that it may be determined by the council in consultation with the minister.
Sorry, I didn't agree with that. My apologies, but I thought also that we shouldn't be bracketing whatever that is, deputy directors, etc., that should be included. That is the principle I wanted to stress. And in addition to that, I think the oversight in consultation with the minister is one that should be emphasized. I support that. Thanks.
Honourable George?
Madam Chair, I want to plead with Mr. Chauvet. At the moment, we are not saying we reject your proposal. But unfortunately, it is very difficult for us to accept or reject your proposal when you don't know where you come from. You do not have proper motivation. You see, we had three directors. Now you say they must be removed. and the director. Now, firstly, what's going to happen? This director, is he going to work alone, and what's going to happen?
Mr. Choki?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Perhaps to read from the principal, I think the appointment of three deputy directors was only limited to the deputy director of law enforcement, finance and administration, and training. I think that was also the original reason why the reference to the deputy directors also was the change was proposed.
No.
So when there are other functions of the authority, it should be reflected as well in the structure.
No, but then you need to determine the structure before you come here and you say give us a check, blank check, for us to determine it afterwards and you pay. Because that's what it currently says.
Mm.
If we accept the changes as it is, it's saying you give us the money, we will decide whether it's 20 or 30 or 40 deputy directors. And I take the point of the council as well. The council must have a say in this.
Mm.
Must have a say in this. And what we can rather do, General Jacobs, if we can ask you, we can come back to this issue tomorrow. If the technical committee secretary through you, if they can have a relook at this thing to bring in the principle, we leave the three deputy directors as it is. Bring in the principle of in consultation with the minister, as well as make a one sentence provision if the structure of the organization needs to be broadened, that there will be a process and talk to that process as well. Because then we are covering ourselves in terms of our oversight responsibility as well. They're not open-ended. Honourable Stuber?
Thank you, Chair. Just something, I don't know whether I'm wrong. On 14.2C, page 30. Ensure that the functions of the authority are performed in terms of the Act and the Levies Act. And what about the PFMA? PFMA must come in there. Thank you.
You're absolutely right. Can you also include that? I think the change in three, again, we would accept the he's/her, but the deputy directors in brackets is out of the question. There's been no motivation why you would suddenly need six more deputy directors, or two more for that matter.
Can we then continue
where we left off?
Yes.
Page
33. Thank you, Chair. Page 33, the annual report, insertion of proposed section 16A. The council must prepare and submit to the minister an annual report in the form prescribed by the minister within 5 months after the end of the financial year. 2, the annual report referred to in subsection 1 must include the following documents. A, the audited financial statements prepared in terms of the Public Finance Management Act, the Auditor General's report prepared in terms of the Public Finance Management Act, and C, a report on the activities of the authority undertaken during the year to which the audit relates, including matters pertaining to the exemptions granted or refused and the reasons for such refusal.
Members, I'm opening up. Honourable Stuart.
Chair, in the report on the activities, we spoke earlier about the firearms register and there must be a report if a firearm's been discharged. And all those things, that is reports that must go to the minister on a frequent basis. And I would like just to see that those also included in the annual report. Otherwise, the annual report is including related matters, and we leave it out. I think we must be more specific. And I can't say offhand what I think must come in there, but there's more that can come into the annual report in order to do better oversight and everything that's related to it.
Can we make a suggestion that when you talk about the the annual report, that you look again at section 2 and you draft a sentence that says, including all information for the financial year as is prescribed in section 2. I'm just
something
mentioning, and with those that we added already, that we said you must add. So all those quarterly reports basically needs to be contained in the annual report as well. Because currently, as we sit here, we do not have an understanding of the private security in the state because of a lack of information. Okay, can we continue? And then we will come back to the, Mr. Hartlis.
Chairperson, I'm sorry to take the committee back quickly, but section 16 on page 32, we'll see in the amended introduced bill, we're substituting this section with another section, and it's actually the funds of the committee is now substituted with a new clause, finances of the committee. That's another section that needs to be aligned. So that one is not correct, the one with, that we have on page 32, section 16, because the introduced bill provides for new section 16, which actually complies with the intention of the amendment here, but because of the alignment with the PFMA, it's a revised clause that we introduce in terms of section 16. So we'll ensure that that one is also corrected. Thank you, Chair.
That is fine. I think we've taken a principal decision. This is what we want, but it, in order for record keeping, we need it to be reflected here as well.
Mm.
Can we, when we look at 16C as well, when you talk about the exemptions, we said when we spoke last time that it mustn't only include the refusals, it must also include the reasons for granting exemptions. So it's refusal as well as reasons for refusal as well as reasons for granting. You can continue.
Thank you, Chair. I think the provisions that are deleted on page 33 is as a result of the Public Finance Management Act and those measures that have been included, Chair. Then the next issue is on page 36.
Can you just explain there for us, because I'm not sure that we... Are you now saying this is not necessary because of the PFMA? PFMA now applies.
That's correct, Chair.
Okay.
And it's, I think those provisions are more elaborate than this, Chair.
Hmm.
Chair, on page 36, you said you want to discuss all the red issues. These were not previously discussed, if I'm correct. And that relates to the issue of the 50% of ownership and control that's exercised by South African citizens. And despite subsection 2, the minister may, taking into account the security...
Okay, I can stop you right here. This committee has taken a decision this morning. So this section can be removed.
Thanks, Chair. Chair, there are, I suppose, on page 37, clause 6 as well. Also, also runs with the same principle, Chair.
Can I ask, just to be safe, I would suggest that we do the following, members, with your agreement, that from page 36, where it deals with this issue, that we ask the technical committee to go and clean up this properly. So take out what needs to be taken out, make sure that consequential changes are nowhere to be seen, then rather report back to us tomorrow on these, so that we know we're dealing with a clean copy on this one, because the committee only took that decision this morning. So I think it's a more fair way of dealing with the issue. Then you can rather move to the next issue that you believe we should be discussing, General Jacobs.
Thank you, Chair. On page 38, the insertion...
Madam Secretary, help me. You're talking now, page 36, that section C, 2C. I think my understanding is that it's going to be listening to what the report from DTI. That is going to be, you need more research on these.
That's exactly why I'm saying to them they must take it out. The committee took that decision only this morning, so they couldn't take it out because we only took that decision this morning. Mm-hmm. So it now needs to be removed. They will come with a clean copy, and they must make sure that wherever consequential changes refer to foreign ownership, that it's taken out as well.
Yes, okay. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair. Page 38 then, paragraph B8. A certified copy of a valid South African identity document of a person referred to in paragraph A. Just one of the additional requirements. Then, Chair, on page 39.
This would change as well. It's also relating to foreign ownership. So that's why I say clean out this whole thing. Can we just ask also 3821B, the application fee as determined by the authority. We don't want a situation where we are taken again to court as is currently the case. And I think here we must also, while you're re-looking this whole thing, look at the Levies Act, and maybe it shouldn't read the authority, but it should read the Levies Act. Or, I don't know. You must go and look at the wording around it. Secretary?
Just to explain, a fee is different to a levy, so we would have to re-look at that.
Yeah. But the point I'm making is we don't want an arbitrary decision, then it gets challenged in court, and the authority is then without standing. So we must just clean up that part of it as well.
Madam Chair, I want to add to what you're saying, that this issue of increase of the levy, look at all that thing, but the council must also be involved, the minister must be involved, it can't only be the authority take a decision to arbitrarily increase by 170%, and then we're taken to court, and then there's a stop of funding.
I think the Honourable Member is quite correct, because previously when we discussed this issue with the Council, we were told that Treasury did agree with them. Now, from our painful experience, we don't know whether that's actually the case, and we want to make sure that the Act spells it out. So if it includes the Minister of Finance, it includes whoever else, have a look at it technically and come back to us on that issue. General Jacobs just indicated to me, I think you must skip everything up to page 42 and then you can start again there, because then you can first have an opportunity, or 41 rather, at the bottom, then you can clean up those sections so that we don't have things that we didn't want there. So can we start at 41 again? Am I correct? That's where we will start again.
Yeah.
Okay.
Chair, on page 41, clause 5 is just a deletion of directorate for special of special operations, which was addressed in other legislation. Clause 6, despite the provisions of subsections 1 and 2, the authority may on good cause shown and on grounds which are not in conflict with the purpose of this Act and the object of the authority register any applicant as a security service provider, except that an applicant who is not a citizen, I think that also relates to the previous one, may not be registered as a security service provider. It's part of the cleanup, I think, Jay.
Mm.
Yeah, and you must take in consideration the whole issue that Home Affairs raised around that as well, please.
Clause 7, the minister may on good cause shown and on grounds which are not in conflict with the purpose of this Act and the objects of the authority, subject to section 23A4, exempt any person in respect of certain categories of a security service from the exclusion referred to in subsection 1A or 6.
That will also have to be cleaned up.
Yeah.
Subclause 8, Chair, the Minister must take a decision within 90 days of receipt of the application for exemption contemplated in subsection 7, and in the case of refusal, provide the applicant with reasons within 30 days of the date of receipt of request for reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Subclause 9, the Minister must publish the details of any exemptions granted under subsection 7 in the Gazette.
Mm-hmm.
Is it only those granted or also those refused?
Bottom of page 41, exemption.
Oh, this is a hand here at the back.
Thanks, Chair. In this particular section, Chair, this is in line with Paja, with Paja Shepherd, but it would be the applicant that applies for reasons. So it would be reasons for refusal, which is in line with what is in Persia in this particular section.
No, if you talk about the Tazad, should we go? Because that does not go to the person who applies. Because that then does not go to the person who applies.
Hang on.
No, it's fine. It's fine. Thank
you. Are you coming?
No,
the Gazette is a public document, members. Gazette is a public document. Can we clarify that issue? Can we clarify? Because you raised that point last week as well, I remember that, where you said that it's not necessary for the minister to provide reasons for refusal and let the applicant ask the minister for reasons for refusal. So we must keep that in mind. We need to keep that in mind. So then, actually, as it is, it's correct. Then we don't need to have refusals in here as well. Okay, continue.
Thank you, Chair. We deal then with the Exemption Advisory Committee. It's proposed clause 23A. And, Chair, I believe that the committee has referred here to NICOC, and I will just give an explanation on why we have phrased it in the way it is. The Exemption Advisory Committee is hereby established. The committee consists of a representative of the authority, the Civilian Secretariat for Police, the Department of Home Affairs, the Service, the Department of Trade and Industry, and the State Security Agency, appointed by the Minister. Chair, I believe there was reference to NICOC, and there was also a discussion on the level of the officers involved, with the officials involved. The problem with NICOC itself is that it's actually the Director General of the State Security Agency, the Head of Crime Intelligence, which is on the level of the DG, as well as the Defense Intelligence, which is also on the level of the DDG. So the proposal that we have is that if there is a representative from State Security Agency, as well as from the Police Service, then it's actually only Defense Intelligence that's not included here. So the proposal is that we not refer to NICOC, but to these departments involved here.
Chair, I understand that the DGs and the agencies is part of, they sit on NICOC. But NICOC got a director and personnel. Let's not go that way. If we put in the police and state security, may be fine. Because in the first draft it was only state security, and I said, what about the others? Then rather put somebody that is covering all three of them to put in there, because it was over the fact that there's state security involved, and who's doing the estimates on state security? It's NICOC. It's not somebody in state security or somebody in the police. It's NICOC, and That was the motivation. Thank
you. Are you more comfortable with subs being in there?
No, I'm comfortable.
So we can keep it as it is now. Okay,
as long as they don't send along a constable to sit on this. I presume.
Anything is possible.
Yeah.
No. Don't say that.
Chair, Subclause 3, the representative of the Civilian Secretariat for Police must be a legally qualified person and must chair the committee. Sub 4, the committee must make recommendations to the minister in respect of exemptions referred to in section 23.7, but Chair, maybe we must expand that to all exemptions. Subclause 5, the minister may prescribe procedural matters and the factors to be considered in relation to the function of the committee referred to in subsection 4. 6, the regulations referred to in subsection 5 must be tabled in the National Assembly for scrutiny and adoption, A, within 6 months of promulgation of this Act, and B, thereafter at least 30 days before promulgation of the regulations, while I think there should be Parliament is in session or after the next session starts.
Members, can I hear your comments? Are we happy with this draft now? This has not been there. This is a committee suggestion, so are we satisfied with the way they've captured it? And we are in agreement that it includes all exemptions, because there were the other exemptions in the Principal Act as well. Okay. Yeah.
Include all exemptions.
disagreement, you can continue.
Chair, on page 44, proposed clause 26, the authority may suspend the registration of a security service provider if, A, there is a prima facie case of, one, improper conduct in terms of this act, or two, the commission of an offence referred to in the schedule. B, the security service provider fails to comply with the obligation to pay the levy in terms of Section 4 of the Levies Act, or C, a security service provider fails to comply with any provision of this act.
May I just ask a question here? Why do we say may suspend?
Chair, I think it's more a matter of indicating a power, because it is not the suspension won't be applicable in all cases. It's something that must be considered and then a decision made. So I think it's just that maybe the state board advisors can help. It's just a way of expressing the power that the authority has in that regard. Because the outcome will depend on the fact of the case.
Honourable George?
Madam Chair, I think I understand the question of me. You see, if suspension of the registration service, you're talking a business. So it means there are other stakeholders that must be involved.
Mm.
Because I don't believe that when we are making this law, we are also having other laws. See, I don't believe that this authority can just be given pure without consulting other departments of that deep business. That it can just wake up one morning because, I'm just making an example, a levy has not been paid, then you suspend business. I think May is, to me, Madam Chair, it's a very, very serious thing. This. I'm assuming that it allows them to do proper consultation with other departments that are involved.
Agree.
Thank you, advisors.
Thank you, Chair. I agree with the explanation given by General Jacobs. It is an empowering provision. It's fine with us.
The only reason why I'm asking this question is because unfortunately we're not seeing that kind of action taken by the authority. And that's why I'm asking that question. And maybe I'm doing exactly what I warned members against. I'm trying to legislate for the current situation. So let's leave it then as may. Can we continue, please?
So we have to put that one then.
It can go on.
Thank you, Chair. Then sub-clause 2, the authority may suspend the registration of a security business if any of the grounds contemplated in subsection 1 pertain to, and then the proposal is to delete natural person referred to in section 22. It will broaden then the applicability.
Yes.
Here, please.
Chair, on page 45, the insertion in subclause 5, the registration of a security service provider lapses if A, it is not renewed as contemplated in section 22, or B, the amount payable for levies in terms of section 2 of the Levies Act is not paid to the authority within 3 months of the date of suspension of the registration of the security service provider concerned, unless the authority determines otherwise. And then the insertion of 5A, if the registration of a security service provider has lapsed in terms of subsection 5, the authority must publish a notice in the Gazette indicating A, the name of the security service provider, B, the period after which the registration has lapsed, C, the reason for the lapsing of registration, and D, the effect of the lapsing of registration.
Member, can we have a discussion on that, or are you in agreement with it? Lapses is not the same as the section that we just discussed, which is the withdrawal suspension. It's not something different. Okay. Honourable Molebatsi?
Can you give me an example of the effect of the lapsing of a registration? Just to give me an indication.
Example of a lapsing and the effect thereof.
Madam Chair, if the registration has lapsed...
Sorry, can I just ask that... just indicate so that I can acknowledge you. I mean, you can't just start speaking. Don't put on a light before I acknowledge that you have the right to speak. Mr. Choki?
Thank you, Honourable Chair. When the registration has lapsed, it means that the applicant or the service provider must apply again. And if the registration has lapsed, he cannot basically trade again before a new application is submitted and approved. That's the effect. Until it's approved.
Are we happy with that, members?
Just for safeguards.
George?
Safeguards, Madam Chair. What happens if the person concerned has done everything which was required of him or her, and then the authorities take long until the required term lapses?
Can I ask that you look at that issue also in terms of the Administrative Justice Act, so that, you know, we maybe put in a paragraph referring to the Administrative Justice Act and the 90 days period, etc., to address the Honourable George's concern.
Anything else on that section, members?
No. You can continue, General.
Thank you, Chair. If we can go to page 51. Chair, this is a really practical issue that we've experienced in terms of appeals. At the moment, the Act reads that an appeal committee contemplated in subsection 1 is appointed by the Minister for every appeal. In practice, it causes stacks of documents submitted to the Minister, whereas an appeal committee can just be once appointed or from time to time. So, Chair, we firstly want to recommend, and it's really from the police service and my specific office that we have this experience, that we delete the words "for every appeal."
Yes.
And then, Chair, once again, as you've said, a lot of issues will come from the funding model, etc. But at the moment, there's no certainty in the Act. It just says the Minister can appoint the appeal committee. So, at the moment, the SACH is actually paying for the appeals. And we have an opinion from the State Law Advisors that say this should be with CIRA. So it's a very difficult situation for us, and it's really something that can't continue in that fashion for us to be above board in terms of what we're doing. So, Chair, if we can just flag the, in terms of the funding model, how are we going to deal with the payment? And we, as I said, the State Law Advisors gave a very, very in-depth opinion with reference to some justice structures, etc., where the same model is followed and where the board or whatever is actually responsible for the payment of the, and it doesn't affect the independence of the appeals committee.
Members, there you have it. I hear what General Jacobs is saying, what is members' feelings around this. I think we are in agreement with General Jacobs, they need to look at that.
Can I ask a question, Madam Chair? So if you remove for every appeal, are you effectively saying that it's going to be a standing committee?
A standing committee.
Chair, a person or persons can be appointed as a committee. It doesn't mean they will sit. They are sitting in an office. Once there are appeals, they are submitted to the committee. And they consider it just as we do at the moment. But at the moment, the minister must actually say, I hereby, in terms of section so and so, appoint a committee to consider the appeal of this person, that person. And every time there's a. What we have done in the present, that we have clustered some together. But because it's a continuous thing that you actually have to make every week, or you actually have to make new submissions to the minister. And really not considering anything and signing off the appointment of the appeals committee.
May I ask, is there not a possibility that you can look at this as part of the standing committees of the council? We're now already talking about a standing committee advisory committee that we're going to, that's going to consist out of XYZ. Can we not look at the appeal committee as a second standing committee of the council, and that the funding then comes from, as you say, the authority? Might mean that, you know, we'd be more specific in that section that deals with the council and the committees as well, and then we can continue with it here in terms of detail.
Is that a possibility?
We can look at it, Chair, although I realize, you know, that in terms of an appeals committee, you actually would need some renewal from time to time for perceptions and a lot of issues. So the minister would definitely have from time to time to appoint a new appeal committee. And but we will look at the issue and see whether we can deal with it in that fashion.
Honourable George, and then state the advice.
Madam Chair, if we were going to appoint people from heaven, I would have no worry. But if you're going to appoint people from this world, and then you appoint them as a standing committee, you must understand that this is not a very clean industry. There's a lot of corruption. Of course, there's generally corruption in the country. Now, if you're understanding people, it's very easy if those people got, they don't have billions, some of them. Some companies got trillions. If they know that Ndlovu is the one who's supposed to deal with the case beforehand, they can, before the case is done, Ndlovu is given, he's a very poor man. If you give him 500,000. He might think out that 500,000 is a lot of money. And then the case is, that's why I'm saying, I'm worried. You see also, people with no interest. You're killing that when you have a permanent committee. Because every day, everybody can just easily have an interest overnight. I'm not saying general, that's wrong, but I just consider carefully the implications of having a standing committee.
I think members, as they are contemplating that, I must ask members also to contemplate the problem that they are experiencing, where it actually delays appeals, because they have first every single appeal they've got to appoint a separate appeal committee. Now, if you look at the Firearms Control Act, there's an appeals committee there as well. And maybe what we should do is have a look at that appeals committee and see whether we can't word something similar to that so that we cover the concerns that are raised, but also cover the concerns that the delay that is taking place because of the minister having to appoint somebody every time. You know, I find it interesting that in this section there's a reference to the minister and remuneration. But in the rest of the act, you know, we don't bother doing that. State
law advisors. Chair, I was going to question, Chair, that it may be important to keep this committee separate from the other committees, Chair, because of the issue of independence, because it deals with appeals against decisions of the authority. Thanks, Chair.
We basically always saying is you must look at the funding model, as you indicated, for this appeals committee. And then also the fact that it's appointed, and if we are going to have a permanent, more permanent appeals committee, we have to look at the time periods appointed for a period of, etc., etc. I have to make it clear that as well. So you will have to come back to us on 51 pages.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. And I think maybe in all what we are raising about this appeal committee, the period, the funding, and maybe the security clearance of those individuals, maybe after 6 months they need to be, just to deal with this issue of corruption and members of those that appeal committee to be tempted to take bribes. Thanks.
I think we need to take all of from 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 in consideration, because 3 it becomes a problem as well, where it says it's got to be independent from the authority. We need to reword that so that it gets its funding from the authority, but it's still independent from the authority, that type of thing. So you will have to clean up this section for us.
I just wanted the committee to be clear on something, that this committee is slightly different to the Firearms Appeals Committee when we clear this up, because the Firearms Appeal Committee sits in it full time. With this Appeals Committee, the way it works is we appoint legal people from legal firms to handle different cases. So when we're cleaning it up, we need to bear in mind that we don't have the same kind of volume of appeals that the Central Firearms Registry has. So we're not necessarily talking about full-time people in any way.
Nobody suggested a full-time committee. None of us suggested a full-time committee. All we said is that you have a look at the wording around that and whether there's not a way that we can do it.
I'm worried about this centenary thing because the motivation for General Jacobs to have a standing committee is because he one of his biggest motivations was the volume of work. And he even said that they cannot afford to appoint a committee every time and again. And if correct me, General Jacobs, if I'm wrong, because then you are opening the discussion. I don't know the volume of work, but you said one of the reasons why you cannot afford to appoint a committee every time and again.
No, I didn't hear that, but I would ask General Jacobs to clarify it himself.
No, Chair, I think it's not really about the volume. If I look at the volume we receive per month, I would say that if you have one person that's appointed as an appeals authority, at present I think we use three or four different attorneys. I would say the volume would not keep one person busy for the whole month. I don't think we need a permanent appeals authority. But now as the Act reads, you actually need to make a submission to the minister for each and every appeal to appoint an appeals authority, which is placing a huge administrative burden on the minister. So it's not really in terms of the work volume. And Chair, I think we can always, if the work volume increases, we can always appoint another person or additional persons to assist with this work, but also on a part-time basis. But the need is really not for a permanent committee like the firearms appeal.
No, I think we're clear on that, but all we ask is you just clean it up, tighten it up, and also look at the issue of the financing around this as well. Continue, please.
Thank you, Chair. If we can go to page 58, dealing with the regulations and some insertions that's made there in section 35D, the registration by the authority of security service providers, including the procedures in relation to the suspension, withdrawal and lapsing of registration. Insertion of proposed section CA, the required percentage, and I think that will fall away now, Chair, into the respect of the amendments that the committee has approved. On page 59, Chair, to insert the uniform, insignia, emblem, title, symbol, and registration and identification certificates of security service providers. And then on page 60, the insertion of paragraph LA, the types of information which security service providers must furnish to the authority when rendering a security service outside the Republic.
Then I just want members to have an opportunity to speak on those that you have. Let's start at page 5835B, including procedures in relation to the suspension, withdrawal and lapsing of registration. I think we can all agree to that. It makes logical sense. The uniform insignia, emblem, title, symbol, and registration and identification certificate of security providers. How does that? What's the impact of G on that?
I think there might be some overlap, but I think that you will see that later on we have included that proposal that we made in terms of the uniforms which overlap with are similar to that of the police service and the. But maybe we must just tidy up between those two paragraphs to maybe have one single one.
Can you combine F and G and bring us one paragraph here, please? And I think we must be clear in terms of what worries me is the fact that despite this being on the books already, is that you see security service providers with emblems on their vehicles that are similar to SAPs, and they use blue uniforms that are similar to SAPs.
Mm.
So maybe one needs to look at colour as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And not only similar to SAPs. Some they've got camouflage, and you know we need to tighten that one up also. Thank you.
But the point members are making, it's on the books, it's not being implemented.
Mm.
And it needs to be implemented as well. Okay, can we continue with that?
LA has already dealt with. I don't know if there's any comments on that, and the types of information which security service providers must furnish to the authority. I mean, rendering a security service outside the Republic is just to broaden the scope of the information that must be submitted. And then on page 61, Chair, minimum standards applicable to security service providers responsible for the safe transportation of cash and other valuable assets. I think that has been dealt with already. And then subparagraph 3, regulations made in terms of subsection 1 may, in respect of any contravention thereof or failure to comply therewith, prescribe as a penalty a fine or imprisonment for a period not exceeding 5 years. And then lastly, subparagraph 4, the minister may, after consultation with the council, issue guidelines or policies in relation to the governance of the authority.
Do you have it? Can we get comments, or are we happy with those suggested changes? Can I just ask a question? It might still be coming, I'm not sure, I can't remember the principal act that well. But the issue of safeguarding of key points, are we addressing that? And if we're not addressing it, shouldn't we be addressing it in this bill as well? I know there's a key point act, so we need to look at that as well. But you will remember there were quite a few companies that were here that said, we are foreign owned, but we guard your key points. Okay, members, I'm just going to give over to members before I allow. Mr. Stuber?
LA, the type of information which security service provides, can we get an example of the type of, is it somewhere in the Act, the type of information that they are obliged to give, or do we just say type of information?
I will give the department an opportunity to respond. Take notes, please. He's talking about, hey, how many people are chairing this committee, Mr. L, he's talking about LA on page 60. On Lombo?
Yeah, thank you, Honorable Chair. You say that the question that you have spoken about is not only the national key point. Some of our police stations are guided by security companies, of which I think that one also needs to be looked at. You know. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I was responding to the question of the national key point. Just to say that the national key point is act is being administered by SAPS. So any the declaration of national key points, the guarding of the national key point areas and so on, it's solely in the area of SAPS, and it's not administered in terms of our act.
I think the point was that CIRA's got a role to play, at least when a company is appointed, there must be a check with CIRA as well to say, is this company reputable, are they paying their levies, are they adhering to it? That's basically what we're saying. You can't just abscond your responsibility. That is what we are saying. Honourable Choke, now I'm thinking about Choke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Those requirements are covered in the National Key Point Act, and I know for a fact that they do require persons who guard those areas to be CIRA compliant and to comply with our Act and regulations.
I still believe that you want access to the Firearms Control Act. You've got a responsibility and an obligation, and there's nothing wrong with this committee putting your obligation in the Act as well in terms of the national key point. And that's what we're asking the technical team to go and look at. It's a two-way communication, and that's what we're trying to establish. Ms. Altman, and then the Secretary of Police.
It's Chair, just to say that we support that, and I think it will also strengthen the authority in doing so and making those cross references. So we would look at that.
Firstly, on the national key points, I think that you can put certain things in the Act, which then enable FACTS to better be able to deal with national key points, including the issue of who guards national key points, because I think on a phone-in program, that was a big issue that came up last week during a phone-in program. The second thing I wanted to refer to was what type of information do they have to supply to the minister. I think that the minister has to prescribe that so that he can't wake up in the morning and decide this company that's operating outside the company must give me this information. There must be, everybody must know that if they operate a security company, if they're a South African-owned company operating in Libya, this is the type of information that the minister prescribes in regulation as to what type of information they would need to supply. And I think that relates to us sometimes waking up in the morning and finding that there's a company operating that South African owned and we didn't even know it was operating. So I think that the question of what sort of information would need to be spelled out and prescribed in regulation, that's my understanding, and so that it's clear to everybody and it's not discriminatory. And then just with regard to the issue of guarding, I think it's not so much an issue necessarily with regard to the police anymore, because the police have taken over the guarding of their own buildings. But I think that there are initiatives within government to start saying we need to look at who's guarding government buildings. So it's a broader issue than just police. And that may also be something that we may need to look at wanting to tighten up within the Act as to who's guarding government buildings.
There was an Honourable George and Honourable Stubbe.
Madam Chair, I've got one question, but the other one is just a question to General Jacobs and the State Advisors. The one question is, if you're saying this company must give information, what companies, we are given three types of companies. Let's talk about a company that operates in South Africa, but its owner are in Germany. Are you expecting that company also to give information? You must remember its headquarters is in Germany. They're not controlling South Africa. Or are you talking about companies that are in? Because we've given three types of companies that operate in the city. Companies that are operating in South Africa, but their headquarters and control is somewhere else. Can we be clarified which company? Number two, that's what I wanted, just for information from General Jacobs and there seems to be magistrates and other people not very concerned about this prescribed sentence. Are you here to witness this thing of prescribed penalties?
Honourable Stubbe?
Just to get back to the type of information, it's, for me it's open-ended, and shouldn't there be a document that states what exactly is needed? You know, it's hanging in the air. You may ask the one firm, how many people have you got in your service, and the other, how many vehicles, and you leave the others out. Doesn't there be a prescribed document with info that's been needed? Otherwise, what's the sense of putting something in here that you don't know what it is?
Just before I give the State Law Advisors and the Secretary an opportunity to respond to it, I think what we need and what I hear from members is where we talk about LA, when reading the security outside the Republic as prescribed in regulations, because that would cover the Honourable Stubbe's concern as well. I heard the Secretary saying that, but it's not saying it clear yet, so I think we just need those words to be added. State Law Advisors, if you can respond to or General Jacobs to Mr. George's question on the companies. I would think it's all companies who are made use of South African citizens, etc.
Chair, if any person conducts the business of a security service provider, they need to be registered if they conduct it in South Africa. So whatever the country is where the company originates from is irrelevant. All of them must be registered to perform that service. And you'll see, Chair, where we have the issue of security services that are delivered outside the country. We specifically refer to persons who are deployed from South Africa. For example, with the security services delivered for anti-piracy operations. It is a UK company. And once again, they won't, because the people are just deployed from South Africa, they don't operate in South Africa. We have made that distinction, that where people are just deployed, that the person himself, once he moved through South Africa to be deployed from here, that person must give notice to the authorities. But otherwise, any company that has a security service or acts as a security service provider in South Africa needs to be registered. And that is the relationship with the authority that's required there.
Madam Chair, unfortunately, General Jacobs, I understand the registration part. I'm talking here about information. This company is headquartered in UK. They are taking some of their members from South Africa to deploy them in Sudan. And they cover them with some information. That's why I probably agree that the open-endedness, that's what worries me. Now you're saying that this company now is not controlling someone. And it's only taking their staff, their employees. You're saying now it must give information. What information? If it refuses, what are you going to do? Are you going to deregister them?
George, I thought they actually explained this issue, because with registration, some of this information will already be required. And then General Jacob said if it is a question of individuals going out, that person will be required to provide information, if I heard him correctly. But it doesn't make a difference whether the company is in South Africa controlled by South Africans or whether it's a company controlled in the UK. There are laws to which this company must adhere to. And that's what we're basically saying. As much as the South African company will have to adhere to the laws in that country. But maybe you can clarify it further.
Yeah, I can further add, Mr. George has mentioned the issue of Sudan. Once a person is performing security services in a country of conflict, like Sudan, then he would require permission from the National Convention on Arms Control Committee in terms of the mercenary and related activities legislation. So that's an additional safeguard in terms of the constitutional imperatives.
And the openness of the issue we've addressed now by saying it, they must be clear about it as prescribed in regulation. So the openness of the type of information we have addressed. Okay, can we continue?
Thank you, Chair. On page 62, subclause 3, the authority must inform the registrar as defined in section 1 of the Firearms Control Act as soon as possible of any change or termination of the registration of ownership of a security service provider that would necessitate the relicensing or disposal of firearms in the possession of such security service provider. Mm-hmm. And Chair, the second one was the obligation you referred to previously that has been changed a bit. The registrar mentioned in subsection 3 must, at the written request of the director, submit a list of all firearms registered to a particular security service provider to the authority within 30 days of the request being made. Chair, the argument is that if there's very specific inquiries or if there's an inspection and specific companies are being inspected, a request can be made on what are the firearms that belong to that company and it can be addressed during the inspection rather than having a whole database that's changing from day to day, etc. Thanks, Chair.
Can we discuss this one as well? I'm worried about 3 personally because I don't know whether you're not addressing new registrations. I think new registrations must also be there. It's just talking about change of some new registration. I mean, they must inform you they've registered a new company that's going to apply, that business requires firearms and they're going to apply to you, as well as suspension. I think subs need to be aware if there's a company that might not be deregistered yet, but that are suspended from doing business for a while, especially when it contains firearms. So maybe we need to strengthen 3A. Members?
Chair,
ethical drafting team to look at, also look at persons, because their registration gets withdrawn, and although the weapon is not licensed in their name, that they have a competency certificate at that company. So it's not just companies that they need to inform the registrar about, but any person who's had their withdrawal of their registration of the security service provider, because otherwise they leave that company and somebody else uses their competency certificate for a weapon.
Specifically talking about the individual guard. I think that's a very valid point as well. Well, George?
That's a question, madam. At what stage do you report to the Firearms Control Act, to the Firearms Control Register? You must remember, if there's a problem, you're dealing with firearms. That's the problem we had when we're dealing with those people who were guarding borders. You suspend them with intention of probably at the long run closing them. What happens in that period? Well, that's the critical period. Because by that time, they can dispose of the weapons. Is there provision for that?
Honourable George raised a valid concern. I think we say as soon as possible, we must say, as per at the time of. I mean, if you send the letter to the company, you send a copy of the letter to subs to the firearm register at the time of suspension, change of ownership, deregistration, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Not as soon as possible, but as soon as possible might be 6 months later and then it's too late.
Meditate, we're not charged for fraud. The asset register moves in immediately, so that by the time you conviction is given, at least the asset forfeiture unit is already aware that these are the types of things we will have to. And I'm talking a similar thing, that once you, the central
on
the register must move in immediately, so that they know how many, even if they are not going to take them, they know that this is the situation, so that by the time it's closed, they are able to move and able to check if there's not been wrongdoing.
So can you tighten the technical committee, tighten up? Honourable Mulabatsi?
Thanks, Chairperson. I want to know, what if a company is suspended that has got firearms, what happens to the for a certain period, what happens to the firearms?
Can Sira respond to that?
Madam Chair, we I'm not quite sure what actually happens to the licenses, but we do report from our side to the Central Fire Embassy, but what actions they take. I suppose that they will have to deal with the authorized person, the person who's authorized in terms of those firearms to it.
See, that's the problem that we sit with. CIRA's working in a silo. It believes its responsibility ends with informing. SAFS deals on its own, it doesn't report back. And the reality, and that's where I believe CIRA is also letting the country down. In reality, what should happen, in my mind, is once CIRA has informed the CFR that we have suspended this trade license of this private security company, suspended, not even deregistered. We now request SAPS to go and take those firearms from this company, keep it in safekeeping until the case has been finalized.
Yeah.
Simple as that. Your responsibility does not stop with just informing them. You've got to give some sort of direction as well. According to our records, they have firearms. We ask SAPS to go and take those firearms out of that company, keep it safekeeping until the case has been finalized. And I think that is what is missing here as well, and maybe we must look at that part of it going forward. Thanks for that, Honourable Malabatsi. Can I just find out, you're now going to move into, is there something else under this one? I would like to suggest that we end today on 64. And then I will summarize at the end of that on the way forward as well.
Thank you, Chair. Page 62, security services rendered outside the Republic. You recall this the section that was inserted as a result of a request from the Portfolio Committee of Defence. Any person who, within the Republic, recruits, trains, hires out, sends or deploys any other person to provide a security service outside the Republic must A. provide to the director on a monthly basis such information as may be prescribed regarding such recruitment, training, hiring out, sending or deployment within the prescribed time limits and comply with the provisions of this Act. Subclause 2, a person referred to in subsection 1 may not engage in any activity or render any assistance that is prohibited in terms of the prohibition of mercenary activities and regulation of certain activities in country of armed conflict Act or the regulation of Foreign Military Assistance Act 1998. Chair, then on page 63, any person who is not a serving member of the armed services of any country and who is being deployed from the territory of the Republic of South Africa to provide armed guarding services outside the Republic must at least 2 weeks before such deployment inform the authority of such deployment in the prescribed manner. Chair, there's a slight difference between the two. In clause 2 is really to cover persons who are deployed by companies outside South Africa for services that's not rendered in South Africa, but they transfer through the Republic and they are deployed from South Africa.
Chair, this clause 3, any person who is not a serving member of the armed services of any country and who is being deployed from the territory of within South Africa to provide armed guarding services outside the Republic must at least 2 weeks before such deployment inform the authority of such deployment in the prescribed manner. Now, what I'm asking here is, there is young people that is working in the UK. They are working as security guards in Harrods, in wherever, any department store. Now, how are they going to do that? Are we regulating here something that we can't regulate? Or what's the reason for putting that in? Because I can't see why we must do that. How are we going to know that? How are you going to know when I'm moving out of the country that I'm not going to be employed as a security guard somewhere? I don't even know. I'm going to look for a job. I'm on holiday and looking for a job and I get a job. How are we going to do that?
General Jacobs, I'm going to allow you to respond to that, just saying that if you're on a holiday visa, you can't look for a job. But
You know, I think it's a very relevant question, and the history of it is a very real one. What we are aiming at here is people who are really expert ex-soldiers of the Special Air Service, special units who are deployed on anti-piracy guarding. And they do circulate through the country. They go to Yemen, get on a plane, come back to South Africa, then go to Yemen again. And there's more involved than only the person. In many instances, firearms are also involved. Now, SAFS has developed a policy in terms of how to deal with the firearms import and export permits and all that. But the one aspect that's not covered is those persons moving through the country, and they are deployed on this type of service. And the only reason why we won't know about them is because it's not a South African company that's deploying
them.
So that is really the... And it's important, I think, to know about these movement of people because, as I've said, it's highly trained people of special forces of all over the world.
If I understand correctly, the intention is not the guy that's working at Harrods. That's not the intention. I think the operative word here is deployed from the territory of South Africa. So the person departs from here, going wherever. But my question is whether you are covering all, because I know of people going outside the country on which is nothing more than security service, but they go there as maintenance officers.
Hmm.
But they actually go there being the guy that's looking after the firearms of that whole group that is there. Are we covering, is it the way that it's written, are we covering what we want to cover? And are we making sure we're not have unintended consequences, as the Honourable Stuber has raised. Maybe you must just look at that thing so that we answer that question clearly as well. I see the Honourable Legetu and then the Honourable George.
I think this serves the purpose, because people leave this country with ill intentions. And it's not for now, but people will read the act after it's been published. So everybody will be going outside with sinister or mercenary missions. We'll know that we do not allow this as a country. That's check.
Madam Chair, this is a very good, I think we must leave it like this. I want to say to Honourable Stuber, this is only meant for honest people. In terms of people who are doing this job, their job, all this, you're not going to, you know, we had a big problem. Some of us were in government that time, during the Iraq war. We lost, I'm talking defense alone, especially highly trained people in the special forces. Because all what was happening, they were recruited by a company in UK, and they go, they won't work in UA, in UK. We only discover when they're in Iraq, we had no knowledge as the country. So that's why I'm saying probably Mr. Stuber is right. It's not something, I remember in the that thing convention, we spent days trying to, how do we deal, but it was very difficult. Sometimes we only knew when we hear that the South Africans died in Iraq. So I'm saying, I don't know how it can be tightened, but it's not an easy thing.
We are requesting them to tighten it, but I want to take more questions from Honourable Stuber, and I have one more question as well.
Thank you, Chair. I mean, there's a clear distinction between a mercenary and a security guard. And I'm now talking on the security guard, not people with ill intention going overseas to do whatever, or a mercenary. I'm not talking about... I'm talking about, because we're speaking here about security, a security officer. And that's the problem that I've... How are we going to legislate them if they're overseas and we don't even know what they're doing overseas? And to me, then, it's no use putting it in. Or we must describe it in a manner that it makes sense. But currently, I can't see why we have to do this.
I would like General Skitter to General Jacobs to comment on that issue, but also looking at whether Honourable Stewart's concern, again, is not covered by the prescribed manner, because you then would require certain information from that individual. And maybe, again, where we say such deployment in a prescribed manner, manner in the regulations of this Act, you know, that we be specific about it. But my question is, 36A1A, so what? Now, the company provides on a monthly basis to the director, so what? Are we again not missing the follow through? Must this not be sent? If you say this is a request from defense, must this not be sent to defense? Must it not be sent to, what is that security body of yours, Mr. Stuber? Nico.
Not Nico.
No, but the point is, what must happen with this information?
Mm.
Are we just gathering this information, or must it be sent through to somebody else? Surely defense had a reason to request this information. So maybe we must just look at what happens to this information and then also tighten the act in terms of that.
Chair, I'm in agreement, because the reason for this was really as a result of the amendments relating to the foreign military assistance environment. And because that act is only applicable where people are being deployed in a country of armed conflict.
Mm.
And this is really for people providing security services, but not in a country of armed conflict, because they do leave with arms and ammunition sometimes and all that other stuff. Chair, I think what I should add in relation to clause 3 is that you will see that what is excluded here is serving members of armed services, and maybe that will put more perspective on the issue. In the Netherlands, for example, personnel of the armed services is being deployed on commercial ships to provide security. A lot of countries use private security to do it. So, and even if the Netherlands armed forces, if they visit a South African port and they have weapons, conventional weapons with them, they need to get permission and whatever from the Conventional Arms Control Committee. So that's the why the exclusion is there. And as I said, even personnel of the armed services of other countries is, I don't want to say the personnel, but the movement of the arms, etc., is being regulated in terms of the Conventional Arms Control Act. And I think that is where the concern comes from people who are highly trained special forces personnel who move through the country to and fro, and in many instances also moving weapons in the same at the same time.
You're talking maritime security specifically, but you're not mentioning it. Is that not part of the problem? Or is it because it's not limited to maritime security?
Chair, the initial draft had actually said guarding services relating to anti-piracy. The State Law Advisors recommended that we broaden it a bit, you know, because these are things that change from time to time. There's always a change of emphasis. And but the real need in terms is presently regarding privacy services.
But you're going to look at the concerns and then just come back on that. Ms. Kulabana?
Just a concern I have here is that, for example, your point 3, 36A3, in that, if a person, if a South African, not serving a serving member of the armed services, right, is hired to go and guard Madonna, and part of that person's contract to get the job is that they must tell no one, because you know the secrecy around where she goes. Oh, she's mobbed by 5,000 fans. Now here you say they must tell these people that they're going to go and do that. Now that would be in breach of their contract. So that just seems to be an unintended consequence of this, because if they do that, then they'll promptly be fired, because now they have breached the contract before they've even left the country. So, you know, a lot of people are hired to go and do guarding jobs of various people, be it a movie star or a whoever. And certainly they go overseas because of the job opportunities, which they maybe don't have here. So I'm just a bit nervous that might have the consequence of preventing people from getting jobs overseas.
General Skutte? Oh,
Skutte.
The police finance is bothering me.
You might have been with him the whole weekend.
Luckily I'm not in charge of it. Jane, I appreciate it shouldn't be too broad. I'm sure, but I think the committee has some feeling on what the real need is that we have in this regard. But we will look at, as the chairman has said, we will look at maybe tightening it up, or maybe revert back to anti-piracy services. As I said, that is really the need we need to address.
I don't think we must limit you to anti-piracy things, is it? Because tomorrow is something else, as you correctly says. Don't limit yourself. Just make sure that we don't have unintended consequences. You're not asking who are you going to guard. I mean, that's not the question that is being raised here. So, and where is the person going on which day? That's not the issue. It is this individual saying, I'm going out of the country. I've been deployed to Mali to protect a water installation in Mali or something like that, if I understand this correctly. Or the guy getting onto a ship that is going to try and protect the ship around the Horn of Africa or whatever the case may be, if I understand this correctly.
Thank you, Chair. I think
it was just a hand from the State Law Advisors as well.
No, I was just going to clarify, Chairperson. There are two things, Chairperson. There's a person who leaves South Africa to go and be employed in another country as a security service provider.
that person will be regulated by the laws of that country. There's a person who transits South Africa to go and guard in another country or outside the Republic, either in international waters or wherever. That person has to comply with our laws by virtue of him transiting through South Africa. Or a person who is deployed from our territory, that person has to comply with our laws, what our laws require.
I asked that question whether the deciding factor is not the deployment from the territory of South Africa, of the Republic. So wanted to add something to that?
No, thank you, Chair. I think we just... Page 64, paragraph D, Chair. Any security service provider who uses or allows the use of any insignia, emblem, title or symbol, whether on uniform or vehicle or otherwise, or wears any uniform which corresponds or can be confused with any uniform, insignia, emblem, title, symbol used by the South African National Defence Force or the South African Police Service. Okay, that has been made an offence for which the punishment is laid down there, and you will see it also links up with the regulations issued to some extent. But Chair, this is really the need that we have expressed in terms of police insignia, and like the member mentioned about camouflage uniforms and that type of thing.
Chair. I think it's clear, Honourable Stewart.
Just it's to get clarity. If somebody is working for a security service and he's been provided with a uniform and he's wearing it, is he guilty of this offence and liable if somebody from the inspectorate sees him with a uniform and it's similar to the army or the SAPS, is that are they going to take him into custody, or what's going to happen with him, or is it it's without his knowledge, he's working as a security guard? The regulation of that, I know we must do something about it, but how are we going to implement it?
Honourable George.
Madam Chair, General Jacobs, if you can clarify me, is there well any uniform? Normally, uniform is worn by individuals, not by companies.
Yeah.
So now, if you say any security, if a security officer employed by a particular company decides for criminal offences to wear a uniform of the either of or one of the state, now you're saying. You see, that's why you people deliberately did not answer me.
I'm going to ask the technical team listen. Otherwise, you're not going to get the questions of the members, please.
Okay. Now, that's why I asked you, General Jacobs, and you did not answer me. I'm a special advisor. Now you're putting here a maximum exceeding 5 years. Here, somebody wearing a security officer employed, he might have acted outside the security organization, but he's wearing, but for serious crime. Now, because now you've limited, that's why I always ask this limitation of prescribed penalties. I will quickly help you.
I think the department can answer to that, but I think the Honourable George is confusing two issues here. The one is that the person will still get the punishment for the criminal act that he's committed, but over and above that, he can also be criminally charged for wearing a uniform that is representing a state organ or something like that. So it's not that this is the one that will... Think. I've got a question, though. My question is, and it's related to the Honourable Stewart. They're going to answer your question, Mr. George. My question is related to Honourable Stewart's question as well. Are we not starting at the wrong end of the stick? Shouldn't part of registration be present your uniform, present your emblem, present the colours, etc., so that it be, and if it is, then we must ask Sarah why it's not doing its job.
Yeah.
why it is that we are seeing people wearing uniforms similar to SAPS uniforms, why it is that we see people driving down the street with vehicles marked similar to that of the South African Police Service. So if the answer is it is part of the registration, then you need to answer to us why you're not doing your job. That's why I'm asking, are we not starting at the wrong end of the stick? Should the registration process not include these things? So you basically sign off on the uniform, the insignia, etc. And how does this impact on Metro Police as well?
Jay, it is really a problem we are sitting with at the moment. If you look at the vehicles and uniforms, as a matter of fact, we have actually made a sort of a project on it in terms of looking at photographs and all these things. And the intention is to go to security companies and actually tell them, look, if you're not going to align yourself, because you must also look at Section 68 of the Police Service Act. It already says already almost exactly the same thing. But the idea is that we also get CIRA on board with this in terms of the enforcement. And because they have this regulatory... because now we have to go to security companies that's already registered. We have to tell them, look, your uniform or your badge or what corresponds too much with that of the police service, and we have to charge them. So this is really to sort of strengthening the legislative framework in order to get a better compliance. Because once they are registered, it really gives us a problem to then enforce the law in terms of a person who is registered in terms of CIRA. With that emblem and whatever.
Can you respond to the Honourable George's question as well?
I think maybe we can use the term a security officer. But the problem is that, you know, if you look at the security service provider, it can be any person who delivers the security service for payment. So it can really be a company as well as a person. But a security officer is a natural person. So you could limit it maybe to a security officer rather than a security service provider.
I didn't understand the Honourable George's question to be that. He was more concerned about the minimum sentence issue around
that.
Is your first question? The second part of it. Honourable. Everybody is honourable today. Mr. Benara.
Thank you, Chair. Honourable members. The issue of prescribing sentences in legislation has been canvassed by the Constitutional Court in the State versus Parliament. And the Constitutional Court has actually agreed that the legislature has got the competence to express itself on how people who contravene the laws that it passes should be dealt with. To the extent that the provision does not cap the sentence, it prescribes a particular sentence, leaving a discretion to the court. In other words, this sentence, the court is not bound to impose 5 years. It can impose something that is less than that, but depending on the circumstances of a particular case that the court can look into. But the court has said there's nothing wrong with the legislature expressing itself on the manner in which offenders can be dealt with in a particular situation. So in this particular sense, this is not basically a minimum sentence type of a provision. The legislature is just expressing itself in a manner in which it would like to see people that contravene this piece of legislation to be dealt with. And that the Constitutional Court in the State versus the Dodo case said it is fine. Thank you, sir.
Yeah, I think we need to look at slightly rewording the sentence, because the emphasis shouldn't be on the guard that wears the uniform, but on the company that supplies the uniform.
Yes,
because I think, as Honourable Member George said, you get given a uniform, you're told to wear it and go guard. So I think we need to just look at making sure that we worded this, because as it says, wearing, it means it's the guard, not the company they get prosecuted. So I think if we could just reword that somehow to prosecute the company as opposed to the guard.
Okay.
Not answering the other question. That is whether we are starting at the right point. We now want to go to industry that is in existence, as General Jacobs has indicated. You want to tell them your uniform is now too close to the police. Yet it was actually CIRA's responsibility to do that. Now staff need to go and do that. Is there provision in the Principal Act for this? Or is it in the regulations that with registration you must provide your uniform, your symbols, etc.? Is it there? CIRA, can you respond?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, there is regulation 13 that deals with the uniforms, which discuss that the if I may read the section, the regulation, it's regarding uniforms, insignia, badges, and firearms. It says every security business must subject to the regulation provide every security officer in its employ with sufficient distinctive articles of clothing constituting standards uniform of that security business if the security officer is required to render security service as contemplated in paragraph 1, paragraph A, C, D, and of the definitions in terms of contained in section 1.1 of the Act, unless the security officer only renders security service consisting of the protection or safeguarding of aspects of natural person. So it goes on and it says that they must wear badges.
You're not answering the question, Mr. Choke. That was not the question. The question is not whether it says they must be provided with uniform. The question is simple. In CIRA's regulating of the industry, do you require the industry to say to you, this is how our uniform is going to look, this is the insignia we're going to use, this is how we're going to mark our cars, so that it does not be similar to that of SAPS? And the answer is simply yes or no.
On the registration.
Yes or no?
My understanding was whether the...
I've satisfied for you what the question is. Is the answer yes or no?
They are not required as part of registration.
Okay. Then I'm saying that we are starting at the wrong end of the stick.
We must provide for it.
We must provide for it in the Act now. We must make an amendment which says upon registration of a security company, the company must provide a sample of, and then we can put that in there, and then you can have all this that it mustn't represent defense, SAPS, whatever else. Even your traffic police officers, it mustn't reflect that either. Maybe we must put all private security companies in orange, I don't know.
But the point is, that
is what we're trying to establish. Are we not starting at the wrong end of the stick? And for me it seems like we are, because we must start there, and so that's something as well. Members, I want to close the meeting. Now, we are scheduled to continue this afternoon. However, I would suggest to members, if you are in agreement, that we do not continue this afternoon. We allow the technical committee to go back to make the changes that we have agreed upon, to clean up in terms of the foreign ownership issue where it still reflects, to clean that up. And then we start tomorrow, General Jacobs, where you've left off. So we will finish the whole bill first, and then we will come back to the changes that we have asked you to do today. So we will start on page 64 and continue from there, and then we can come back with the changes, including this one that we're now saying around the uniforms, etc. Okay?
Thank you.
So that gives you at least the whole afternoon, evening. That never works until 1 o'clock. Let them work until 1 o'clock. Members, thank you very much. Where are we meeting tomorrow? Do you know? Members, the meeting tomorrow morning will start at 9 o'clock, Good Hope Chamber, and there is lunch outside, so please enjoy it. Thanks.
Yeah. Thank you.